But there are times when a radio station like LBC just becomes essentially a bit of a talking shop, offering information, reassurance, even some retrospection. The meningitis outbreak, or a meningitis outbreak, is now being treated as a national incident after an infected person was admitted to a London hospital. The number of cases is rising, and the Secretary of State for Health, Wes Streeting, is pretty clear that it is not panic stations, but it's still something you want to talk about.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, a targeted vaccination programme is rolling out for students in Kent following an outbreak of meningitis. Five new cases have been confirmed overnight, bringing the total to 20. Two people have died in the outbreak, which was first reported on Saturday. Speaking to LBC this morning, Government Minister Nick Thomas-Simmons had this advice.
Anyone who was at the chemistry club on the 5th, 6th or 7th of March should come forward for preventative antibiotics. And on the gov.uk website, there's a number of places, I think four places in total, where you can actually go and get the antibiotics.
The United States has used so-called bunker buster bombs to hit Iranian missile sites along the Strait of Hormuz. Tehran's blockade of the key shipping route has caused oil prices to soar over the past few weeks. The Conservatives will seek to force a Commons vote on scrapping a planned fuel duty rise in September. It's as petrol prices continue to rise as a result of the Iran conflict. Labour says it's been kept under review, but it's too early to predict how prices at the pumps will change in the coming months. Shadow Transport Secretary Richard Holden's told LBC that's not good enough.
We're saying, have a look across the board. There are other places you could find the money from, particularly, we think, concentrating on welfare. We don't think you should be raising taxes on the family car, on the person who needs their van to go to work, or on literally everybody's shop, because actually food has to be delivered to shops right across the country.
Angela Rayner has warned that Labour risks a breach of trust with voters over plans to make it harder for migrants to stay in the UK. The former Deputy Prime Minister has described proposals as un-British. Legal migrants could have to wait up to 20 years before they can settle permanently under the plans. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has previously said the change is needed to avoid a drain on public finances. And Scotland's busiest railway station, Glasgow Central, has partially reopened. It's been closed for 10 days after a large fire destroyed an adjoining building. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 26 points at 10,429. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.15. LBC weather, sunshine for most, the odd shower for the northwest of Scotland, a mild day for England, a high of 18 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
I'm here with Charlie Bigham. What's cooking, Charlie?
My classic fish pie. Made with succulent salmon and delicately smoked haddock, smothered with bechamel and parsley sauce, and all topped off with the richest, butteriest mash and a golden mature cheddar topping.
You had me at succulent.
An unbeatable classic. Cheers.
Delicious. Tastes like home.
You know you don't actually live here, right?
Charlie Bigham's.
Handmade in my kitchen. Cooked in yours.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 3 minutes after ten. A very good morning to you. We've got quite a grown-up show today. I should probably warn you in advance, but I'm sure we'll find room for some fun and frolics and possibly a couple of ferrets as well before the day is out. It's never entirely obvious what question one should ask at times like this. I'm referring immediately and mainly to the meningitis outbreak, the fatal meningitis outbreak that has now been declared a national incident, although as one or two of you have already pointed out, that just means it's reached London. I don't think that's entirely fair. It becomes national when it spreads beyond the area in which it began. We know that two people have died, and we know that an event in a nightclub in Canterbury in Kent has been deemed a super spreader event. Health officials braced for the death toll to keep rising, and the number of cases will probably go up in the course of this programme. I would like to know, and I hope this is an appropriate question and not a silly one, and also not a rhetorical one. I hope it's not a question to which everybody except me knows the answer. But as a public health professional, what is your training with regard to meningitis? What are you taught? As we see things unfolding, I mean, across the southeast, most obviously in Kent, you just heard the cabinet minister doing the studio rounds this morning, talking about the nightclub where if you were there, then you should be seeking antibiotics. I've seen photographs of queues down in Kent at the University of students in masks, trying to get, or not trying to get, queuing up successfully for their treatment. And in a way, the other element of the conversation that I'm keen to have today is about the reaction you have to the word. It's very generation based, isn't it? I think this came across during what I heard of Nick's show. You have a very generational based response to this, and I mean, some people of quite a young age will have had experiences and knowledge of this condition that are chilling. I can say that this is a quote from Professor Susan Hopkins, who is head of the UK Health Security Agency. I can say that in my 35 years working in medicine, in healthcare and hospitals, this is the most cases I've seen in a single weekend with this type of infection. And she goes on, I think in quite worrying words, to say it's the explosive nature that is unprecedented here. The number of cases in such a short space of time. NHS were initially managing it as a major incident in the region, but they now have increased that overlay to having a national level oversight as well. The Deputy Chief Medical Officer added, "This is by far the quickest growing outbreak I've ever seen in my career. It is obviously of national significance." And it was the French authorities who helped us raise the alarm about the outbreak, because the second person to become severely ill had travelled to Kent from France and was admitted to hospital on their return. So what I want to do is I kind of get, with your help, a picture of the now, the little picture, as it were, the specifics of what is currently happening now in Kent and now beyond, but also the bigger picture. What are we trained to do in the context of this particular condition, this particular disease? Can we say anything substantive or interesting about the scale of the spread and the fact that the senior medical officers in the country are clearly quite taken aback by what has happened? We know, of course, that Wes Streeting has described the spread of the disease as unprecedented. We know that a university student and a sixth form pupil have passed away, and we therefore know that parents across Kent and now beyond will be in a state of panic, even if perhaps some of their more chill children are not. Four schools across Kent have seen cases reported, and at least 11 cases have been linked to that club in Canterbury called Club Chemistry, with the government urging today that if you attended an event there on March the 6th or subsequently, then you should definitely seek medical advice. So I'm going to open up the phone lines, 0345 6060973. If you think you know something interesting or useful, I'd just like you to ring in and share it, really. It's not one of those days where I have a laser-like and very specific inquiry. If you have a child at university in Kent, just give me a ring and talk me through what you're doing, how you're feeling. What are they being told? If you are, how dare I presume that my listeners are of a certain age, you are a student in Kent and you tune in daily to the James O'Brien Experience. What's going on? What are you being told? What are you hearing? 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. And if you are a public health professional, because I think about this a lot, I think it's probably because of one of the very first pieces of professional advice that my late father gave me when I was sitting in the newsroom at the Sunday Telegraph doing absolutely nothing. I was just there on work experience, and I wasn't getting much experience or any work. But I phoned my dad to sort of have a bit of a moan, and Dad said, somewhat, I think, indulgently, Dad just said, "You're there in case they need you." which wasn't entirely true because there were no circumstances really in which they would have needed me. But he was talking about the role of a newsroom journalist at the time, and it stayed with me because it speaks to something quite significant about society. The amount of energy and expenditure that you deploy when it is not needed but might be. At the heart of austerity was the idea that if we get rid of this, it won't matter because we didn't use it yesterday. And nobody involved really seemed to say, yeah, but what if we need it tomorrow? Regular listeners to this programme will automatically be shouting gully suckers at the radio, because one of the very first lessons I learned from you was that many councils had stopped using gully suckers. They'd saved money by getting rid of the engines that used to suck all the debris from curbsides and gutters, and therefore when it rained very heavily there wouldn't be floods. But you're only using the gully suckers. It's a bit like a snowplow. You're using it so rarely that the case from the bean counters for getting rid of it could look irresistible if there hadn't been a need for this equipment for a few years or a few months. But of course, if the necessity of having it kicked in the next day and you hadn't got it anymore, then there was a lot of egg on a lot of faces. And that's why I find medical preparation, even before COVID, I find medical preparation quite fascinating. That the people who are there to catch us when we fall, even if we're not aware often of the likelihood or the danger of falling. That this is making sense, right? That they are there in case you need them. And most of the time, you don't even entertain the possibility of needing them. I think a fifth school has now been added to the list of those where cases have been detected. And, I mean, it just adds to the sense of what is in place. 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. As a public health professional or as someone who has experienced meningitis, either personally or in a family context, what is in place? What is the infrastructure? I don't know if it's too soon to ask questions about whether or not it has operated effectively, whether or not it has kicked in quickly enough. But I want to know what it is and what it does. So you, as somebody who has been affected by it, either personally or indirectly, or you as somebody who is in part charged with dealing with it, what is the framework? What is the system that gets activated at a time like this? And if we feel that it is appropriate, then we will also inquire into how effective and successful and prompt that activation has been. I've seen a couple of suggestions that things have moved a little bit more slowly than would be optimal. But if it's an unprecedented spread, if it's an unprecedented speed of spread, then I don't know where you can derive confidence that the response hasn't been quick enough. So to be clear, what happened when it appeared in your life? 0345 6060973. I don't really mind when, because that helps us map how the nature of response, the nature of the framework for coping with this has evolved over the years. So what happened when meningitis appeared in your life? And attendant upon that question will be, of course, the feelings that are engendered when you see it on the front page of all your newspapers and hear it leading all of your news bulletins. And equally important, possibly more important, but equally interesting, is the question of what is in place. So a button has been pressed. I can tell you also, there will be breaking news today that health officials in Northern Ireland are investigating a probable case of meningococcal disease in a pupil at a Belfast school. So things are beginning to spread. We are not in the business of causing panic, but we are great believers that knowledge equals power, and understanding, comprehension, is often the biggest safeguard against unnecessary reaction. So what this button got pressed at the weekend, right? What happened? That's what I want you to tell me. We know that students are queuing up in Kent. We know that a lot of people are very worried about the situation down there. I want the specifics of what's happening on the ground, but also the detail of what would happen anywhere when this alarm is rung, when this button is pressed. Because we sometimes, and I think COVID probably took this smugness away from most of us, we kind of think we got most things licked, don't we, in the West. as a species. We kind of like to think we've got most things licked. The days of, you know, rickets and scurvy and other conditions that could, I mean, polio most obviously, that could turn lives and people upside down. The iron lungs that some of our parents would have been put into when they had tuberculosis. We kind of think that we've got most things licked. And moments like this remind us of the fragility of existence. They really do. But they also remind us of the importance of infrastructure, the importance of the state, actually, the importance of the taxpayer and the government spending its tax money on rainy day scenarios, spending its tax money on the things that are there in case you need them tomorrow. And you only find out whether or not they're fit for purpose and whether or not that money has been wisely spent and whether or not that framework is up to sniff. You only find out when you need them today. And we need them today. So I want to know what it is that will be happening. And I want to know what it is that happened to you when you needed it today. Okay? If you hit the numbers now, you will get through. 0345 6060 973 is the number that you need. Two questions, really, but on a morning like this, we are the water cooler, we are the town square, so feel free to come at it from almost any angle. As a fatal meningitis outbreak is declared a national incident, I want to know what infrastructure is in place, what will be kicking in now? And you can answer that question because you're a public health professional. I want to know what is happening on the ground in Kent, which is at the centre of this outbreak. And I want to know what happened when meningitis made a very unwelcome appearance in your life or your family or your circle. Okay? Thank you in advance. And it sounded a bit like Donald Trump then. That's not something anybody ever really wants to do. But we will, of course, be catching up with his latest aberrations and madnesses later in the programme. 0345 6060 973.
LBC.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon's Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Ring-tailed lemurs, capybara, crazy golf, Cannon Arena, magical wood, and cafes. Let's ride Blackbeard's Buccaneer first, and then slide on the Wave Runner too.
Come on, Dad, let's go.
Right, Jungle Splash, meerkats, quadrupillar, owl displays, honeypot bears, rowing boats. Oh, what fun!
Nutcatch Adventure Park. Book now at nutcatch.com.
This is 40-year-old Kathy, mother of two and self-confessed telly addict.
Daddy? Oh, look at you. That's brilliant. Well done.
This is also Kathy, working as part of a team to keep things calm at her local prison.
Come on. Listen, speak to me.
And helping someone's son write his first letter home in 8 months.
Well done. You should be really proud.
Thank you, miss.
An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
You know what I love about Eurostar? The comfortable seats with lots of legroom. You know what I don't love? Playing hide and seek with my feet. Or playing footsies with my neighbour.
Ouch!
Sorry. Now that I'm on the Eurostar, the only game I'm playing is stretchy, stretchy leg leg, and I always win. That's the ticket.
Eurostar. Together, we go further. Legroom varies by class of service.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
And as you could probably tell from the introduction to this programme this morning, I'm in a state of unembarrassed ignorance. I'm about as well informed as the average punter on a morning like this. I refer to the news. But I also have the extraordinary privilege of being able to ask you. And that is why we sort of assemble a tapestry of experience and understanding that hopefully adds to our general confidence about how things are going. So, what happened when meningitis appeared in your life? What is happening in Kent as this outbreak moves to national incident level? And you can probably tell the thing I'm most interested in, but I'm going to have to work hardest to get, is the explanations and descriptions from public health professionals about what is in place for this very specific and particular problem. Summer is in Corby. Summer, what can you tell us?
Hiya.
Hello.
So I go to the University of Kent. However, I did come home on Monday back to my hometown. But yeah, it's been pretty hectic, to be honest.
What was the first you heard of it?
So I think it was Sunday night, and it was a text from my friend, and it was just the link to the article.
Wow.
The first article that was released about, I'm not sure who it was by, but that was when we first heard about it. I hadn't heard anything from the uni at that point.
And did that contain the news that someone had passed away, or that just that people were
infected? Yeah, that was the first we had heard of it.
So your friend is essentially going, oh boy, check this out.
Yeah. Yeah, and then immediately after that, there was a petition to kind of close down the campus, and we have exams as well, so to get those moved or cancelled, because it was just...
When are they due to start?
So some of them are already back up. I've got mine today, but it's...
So you won't be going?
Online.
Oh, you're allowed to do it online?
Yeah.
Okay. What have you heard from the university? Because clearly they've been in touch with regard to the examination situation. What have they said with regard to the sort of bigger medical picture?
Yeah, so initially they were saying that they were going to keep campus running, and there was kind of a big outrage about that. So there was a petition to shut that down, and they did follow through with that, of course. But now... I'm not really too sure what's going on. There are antibiotics being handed out on campus, but I was in the line for 2 hours, and only when I was five people from the front, I realised it was a medication I couldn't take. So only
because of other
now,
because of underlying health conditions.
Yeah, and now today is the sorry. Today is the first day that I'm taking antibiotics, so it's taken me until today to get something figured out for myself.
And so
I'm got no symptoms, but
what have you been told? What have you been told to look out for?
So bad headache and fever-like symptoms.
When I was a kid, it was stiff neck. My friend's grandma, every time he got poorly, was... And we used to laugh about it. Every time he got poorly, she'd say, is your neck stiff? Is your neck stiff? She'd sort of been raised in mortal fear of meningitis. I think that's one of the things you're supposed to be looking out for as well, isn't it?
Yeah, stiff neck especially.
So you took the view...
Especially if you're feeling confused as well.
But you're not. Clearly you're not, because you're providing us with an incredibly clear...
I'm very, very lucky to be okay.
Took the decision to get out of Dodge. You decided to head home at the first opportunity, just better safe than sorry kind of decision.
Yeah, absolutely. The two different parts of campus in which they've said to for people to get antibiotics are two completely opposite ends of campus.
Okay.
So I assume from that it's spread everywhere, and I was like, I'm leaving.
Yeah, no. Have you got any inkling, I mean, just from your own peer group, how many other people have done what you've done?
Honestly, yeah. I think everyone has up and left. I don't know one person who hasn't, really.
Everyone who can has moved, and everyone who can't is currently queuing up for antibiotics. Well, I've got you, and listen, if I start boring you, or if you've got more important things to do, then do feel free to... But I am interested in another element that may not have occurred to you, and it was... It's your generation having endured, in many ways, the worst of COVID. Mm-hmm. Would probably mean that you're not going to have that slightly, you know, the teenage blasé immortality delusion. When I was your age, I didn't think anything could affect me. Do you know what I mean? I'm 18. Mm-hmm. These things are for old people. But because you lived through COVID and you lived through the incredible privations that were correctly imposed on all of society, it meant that your generation will respond to this with a degree... I don't want to say panic necessarily, unless you want to use that word, but with a degree of seriousness that perhaps my generation wouldn't have felt.
No, yeah, I fully agree. I think it's really important to remain calm. Obviously, it's very early days. We don't know what's going to happen, and most likely it will be okay. However, I do think I've grown up with a lot of health anxiety related to COVID as well, and I think a lot of people around me are very, very similar. And I think another thing I wanted to touch on as well is the fact that we didn't have our vaccines. I'm pretty sure if we were before 2015, most people my age haven't had the MenB vaccine.
No.
And I think people are quite ignorant to that online because they think it's the other meningitis, but this is meningitis B. And so many people haven't had the vaccine for that.
And you're right, because it's a particular strain, isn't it, that is both happening in Kent and also the reason why the spread is so good. Do you know why? I mean, you're not the health expert here, but why the wider eligibility? Wes Streeting has said that the government follows the expert independent advice, but I mean, what are you saying to each other about why your generation didn't get vaccinated for this?
Honestly, we have no clue.
No.
I've spoken with my friends, and we do think that we should have had it. I think we should be having the best healthcare that we can as human beings on this planet, you know?
Yeah, it'll never catch on. And final question, I promise, because you just touched on it yourself. I mean, obviously, I completely agree with you, and there are some very sad stories emerging in the context of what's going on in Kent from people who've lost their children and been calling for this two-dose, £220 private vaccine that teenagers can get. And as you say, the question of why they weren't getting it is one that will have to be asked and hopefully answered. But just on that phrase you used, health anxiety, I know I've heard already from someone who is working with CAMHS in Kent in a relatively senior role and sharing there's an emergency protocol put in place yesterday for the mental health support teams that will support any child impacted across the whole of Kent, whether they're affiliated with an affected school or not. That's something that your generation is also very attuned to, is what you've just described as health anxiety. And I would add to that the mental health impact of a moment like this, which is, let's not kid ourselves, Summer, it's bloody terrifying in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's something that may be accessed.
Yeah, I think if anyone's struggling, there's always places where you can reach out, and no problem is too small or too silly.
That's nice. Thank you. And good luck. I hope this is over sooner rather than later, and I hope nobody, let alone anybody you know, is more directly affected by events. I don't even need to ask what your parents were doing or saying in this kind of moment, because they would be all, as I would be, saying, oh, just come home. Just come home. Worst case scenario. Just better safe than sorry. Just come home, darling. Your room's ready. I was only joking when I said I was turning it into a gym or an office or whatever it was that I thought was hilarious last Christmas. Just get yourself on the train. We'll pay and get yourself home. If you have a child in Kent and they are still there, give me a ring and talk me through what you're going through. But what I really want to push you on is this question of what is in place. So it's there in case you need it. And of course, the vaccine is in many ways the very distillation of that principle. I'm not ill. Why do I need to take this? It's there in case you need it. And the vaccine, of course, builds up herd immunity, but it never delivers 100% immunity. I think that there's a baby who has been taken into hospital, I think in London, who is vaccinated, because it's an age-related thing, as Summer just touched upon. But there's no such thing as full immunity to some conditions. And we don't know why this one is not currently in place. We do know that families like some parents who lost their child last year have said that they wish they had paid private doctors to give the vaccine to their daughter, £220 for a full course of two doses. I don't know. I don't have the qualifications to advise or not advise on going down that path. But if you're doing it, I don't think anybody listening to this can blame you. So what is the infrastructure that's in place? And what is the experience that you had in your family when meningitis appeared? And if you want to add to Summer's story, what is your understanding or knowledge of what is going on the ground in Kent? Cindy's in Walton-on-Thames. Cindy, what would you like to say?
Good morning. I'm actually from South Africa.
That's fine. You carry on.
I picked up meningitis in 1965 when I was 2 years old.
Blimey.
My mum and dad had a trading station in Transkei. And somewhere along the line, I picked up the meningitis and then got TB on top of it.
Oh, Lordy. What can you remember about the first signs of trouble?
No, I can't remember much at all.
Sure.
All I remember is later years of being in the hospital. So, apparently had 20 lumbar punches that were sent to England to be tested.
Really?
Yes.
Good grief.
Yeah. and a paediatrician that I was under would get medication from some professor here in the UK and send them back to me.
There we go. Rule Britannia, leading the world. Those were the days. And so when you hear the word in the news today, you probably have a slightly different reaction from the rest of us.
Yes. I just remember very, very small snippets of being ill. So, yeah, maybe it was a good thing that I was so young.
And you're fine. You don't have any lasting... Because eyesight can often be affected forever, yes. Can't it?
Yeah, my left eye is very badly affected.
Oh, dear.
But my right eye is fine. Yeah, I'll wear glasses, so that's all good.
Thank you, Cindy. And there'll be a lot of people who are hearing echoes from their own past, and they are relevant because, you know, knowledge, as I said earlier, is power. I also said earlier that, of course, if it was my daughter who was in Kent, then the first thing I would do is tell them to get home. But that, of course, might be against medical advice. I didn't feel it would be appropriate to pick it up this summer. I was speaking very authentically about what I would want my children to do. But if it is spreading, then obviously the more people that move away from the centre of the outbreak, then I think I can say this, then that there is a strong possibility the more likely it is to spread. Do I need to be an epidemiologist or an immunologist or a bacteriologist or just an ologist to say that? Possibly that wasn't the cleverest thing I could have said, which is why I was at great pains at the top of the show this morning to stress our shared and unembarrassed ignorance. Here's Dominic Ellis with your headlines.
The number of meningitis cases in Kent has risen from 15 to 20 after an outbreak began on Friday. GPs are being advised to prescribe antibiotics to anyone who visited Club Chemistry in Canterbury between the 5th and 7th of March. Sir Keir Starmer is expected to face more questions from MPs in the Commons this lunchtime over the UK's relationship with the US. President Trump has stepped up his criticism of Sir Keir's response to the Iran war in recent days. And the Conservatives will seek to force a Commons vote on scrapping a planned fuel duty rise in September. It's as petrol prices rise as a result of the conflict in the Middle East. LBC weather, sunshine for most, the odd shower for the northwest of Scotland, a mild day for England, a high of 20 degrees.
This is LBC.
At Lloyds, we love that moment a dream becomes a reality. Like for Steve, he's slowly packing his belongings into a small box. A framed photo of his grandchildren, a pot plant that could do with some water, a mug that reads, "Happy Retirement, Steve." As he waits for the lift one last time, he feels lighter, happier. At Lloyds, we've been asking the nation about their dreams. That's how we know Steve's story and thousands of others just like it. We've been backing the nation's aspirations for 250 years. So when it's time to realise your dreams, we're ready when you are. Bank on Lloyds.
The Famous Five are on the train to Cardiff, planning their Welsh adventure.
"Did you know Wales is absolutely bursting with myths and legends?" says Anne. "And number one on my list is the legend of the Red Dragon."
"Then tomorrow we'll look for the legendary fairies of Pennard Castle," adds Dick.
"But first, let's try the legendary Welsh cakes," quips George.
"Yes, let's start there," laughs Anne.
Great Western Railway. Legendary adventures start here.
Young people today, can they really handle responsibility? Or are we just kidding ourselves?
Welcome to McDonald's. And a
mayo chicken. Some think young people can't manage. We disagree. That's why one in three McDonald's managers are under 25.
Hey, Kira.
Hey, girl. How are you?
Right? Yeah, I'm good. It's busy out there, though.
Like Kira from South London. She's 23 and manages a team of 20.
Let's go.
Leadership. Making it happen at McDonald's.
This was made with human intelligence.
And artificial intelligence.
Just like Intuit QuickBooks business management software. If you're a sole trader earning over 50K from April 2026, making tax digital means...
you have to file your taxes online.
But new QuickBooks AI has
automated tools to help make compliance easier.
I was going to say that. I'll do it with Intuit QuickBooks.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It is 10:33 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Steve in Newcastle, not alone, when he's wondering when we or whether we will be hearing from Messrs Whitty, Valance and Van Tam. I think one or two of them have moved on to new jobs since then. But Keith just pointed out that we are a very different population from the one that we were before COVID. And although meningitis is not an outbreak that leads to lockdowns or anything similar, one wonders what has changed for the worse in us as a population as a consequence of some of those experiences. I'd bet you 20p right now that somebody online is already claiming that meningitis is caused by the COVID vaccine. It's such a lucrative grift for people. In fact, vaccine lies can carry you all the way to the Oval Office. So you know that somebody in that ludicrous universe will already be trying to cause even greater concern with absolute nonsense based on zero understanding or knowledge. And our job on a morning like this is to try at least to address that absence of understanding and knowledge. For example, do we know why teenagers are not routinely offered the Men B vaccine? My understanding, and everything is slightly up for grabs today, my understanding is that the babies get them. The Men B one only kicked in about 2015. Babies get it, but the independent expert advice given to the government was that they didn't need it. We didn't need it beyond that sort of age. And then you worry about the fact that it is available privately. And you think, why would it be available privately if it was of no use whatsoever? And it will be a calculation. This is one of the brutalities of society, isn't it? Is that calculations are made. I always, at this point, for reasons that aren't immediately obvious, I always think about the Jubilee line here in London and the fact that when you pull into Westminster Station on the Jubilee line, you are pulling into essentially a tunnel that comes all the way up to the platform edge. So I don't know if you've been on it, but when the doors open, there's two sets of doors, as it were. One set permanently on the platform and one set on the train. So there is absolutely no possibility of falling under a train or, God forbid, deciding to throw yourself under a train on the Jubilee line. I promise you this is relevant. You're probably wondering what I'm going on about, but I find this stuff really fascinating. The role that the state, that the government plays in our lives and our health and our safety. Because a calculation was made that it is not worth the cost of extending that to every platform, on every train station, everywhere in the country, even on the London Underground, even on the Jubilee line. The cost-benefit ratio is such that the money it would cost to do it doesn't justify doing it, but not doing it will cause some deaths. This isn't Lord Farquhar territory, I promise you. It's just if it costs £1 billion to do something and it saves two lives, then it's not worth society doing it. Because you're doing £500 million a life, and if you were doing that for everything, then there'd be no money anywhere. So that is probably the reasoning behind the. Well, I'm sure that's part of the reasoning behind the fact that it's not made available for teenagers, because the impact that it would make is not big enough to justify the cost that it would incur. 10:37 is the time. Selena is in Lichfield. Selena, what made you pick up the phone?
I'm a 57-year-old female, and at the age of 14, I was struck down with bacterial meningococcal meningitis. And I'm just listening, and I'm just thinking how terrifying it is for everybody at the moment. I just remember how poorly I felt and how quickly it came on.
What happened? Now take me back to the beginning, if you can, if you would.
Basically, it was just after Christmas. I think it was Boxing Day.
Yeah.
I just turned 14 in the November. I went to bed, and then I don't really remember getting up for the next couple of days. I just remember crawling across the landing, trying to tell my mum that my head was so poorly. I was vomiting, being sick. I couldn't have the curtains open. It was just terrifying. I had the doctors come out a couple of times. Unable to diagnose me. It was actually my mum, I think, in the end, that said she's got meningitis.
Really? How did your mum know, do you think?
So I got taken in to Burton.
Yeah.
Lumbar puncture, had septicemia on my hands and feet. They found out that the type I had could have killed me within 24 hours.
Good grief. Mother's instinct, eh? Was your mother medically trained at all, or...?
No, she'd been an auxiliary in a hospital beforehand.
So she knew more than the average bear.
But I was the youngest of four, so I think she knew, yeah.
Yeah.
I just remember how poorly I felt and thinking that, you know, if I'd have... The headache was so severe that if I'd have passed away, it would have been a blessing at the time.
You were in absolute agony.
To read my last rites.
Oh, my days. How do you think it affected you long term, now that you look back on it, and the sort of emotional impact of it all, or the mental impact?
Looking back at the time, I used to be in top sets for most things at school. I think I suffered after that. I was told that I wasn't allowed to do any homework. I wasn't allowed to do any extra, anything that I used my brain for, basically. For a little while, and I just felt like, in the end, when I left school, I was actually taken out of a few exams, and written on the notes were, you know, Selena is quite capable, but she doesn't apply herself.
You said they told me not to.
Yeah, well, exactly. Not only that, but I just feel like I just didn't have the capacity to.
Really, like brain fog, almost.
Yeah, definitely.
Good grief.
And I'm listening to them now, and I'm just thinking, God, it's just terrifying that it's... And it so happens that my best friend now also lived at the bottom of my street, and she had meningitis 6 months prior to me, the very same type.
Good Lord.
So,
do you know where you got it? Did they trace back like they are doing now in Canterbury?
In Lichfield, no.
They didn't try and work out whether you'd been to a Christmas party or something like that? And you weren't part of a wider outbreak then, as far as we know?
No, not as far as I know. I just literally went to bed, and then the next couple of days just couldn't get up. It's just so severe, you'd know. You would know if you...
This isn't right. This isn't flu. And of course, you're a woman as well, so you don't have the danger of thinking that a tiny sniffle is actually smallpox in the way that men do.
No, I was 14. I just hadn't got a clue.
Exactly that. When did you fully appreciate just how serious it had been? When did they tell you? When did you work out? And I mean, leaving aside the severity of the symptoms, you probably wouldn't even have been aware of the word. When did they sort of explain to you, or when did you start to appreciate just how serious?
I don't think until I was actually an adult, you know, I ran the marathon in 2008 when I was 40.
Well done.
For meningitis.
Yes.
Because I think at that point then I realised that, you know, I'd survived this. Now, being, you know, having children myself and being older, I realised that how severe it actually was, and that it could have killed me there and then. But I'm just grateful that I got the care and the intervention that I had as quickly as I did.
Yeah, and then when you turn your radio on a day like today, as with Cindy a moment ago, it's going to impact upon you quite differently from how it impacts on the rest of us.
Absolutely. I'm just listening to you and I'm thinking, oh my God, this is awful. This is awful for those that have been taken in and for the parents. And, you know, I just, any intervention, just don't hesitate. Just get help immediately.
Yeah.
Even if you come out feeling silly, that it's nothing, just get help straight away, because it's just...
Better to be silly than anything else. Yes, I mean, beautifully put. Thousands of Kent students now being offered emergency Men B jabs in an attempt to contain the outbreak. Of course, it takes up to 14 days to develop symptoms, meaning that more cases are almost certain to emerge. And a grim statistic, but I think an important one, that about 1 in 10 people infected with meningitis B do die. 11 of, well, at the state of play this morning was that 11 of the 15 cases identified so far had been at the Chemistry nightclub in Canterbury on March the 5th, 6th or 7th. There are 4 other cases, but they have tragically either died or are currently too sick to confirm whether they had actually attended the club. So, I mean, the seriousness of the situation cannot be exaggerated, but neither, of course, can the fact that the system is doing what the system is designed to do. What we haven't so far managed to establish with great success is what exactly the system is designed to do. And that, you know, might not be a coincidence. It might well be that healthcare professionals at times like this do keep the lid on some of the measures that are in place, precisely because otherwise we'd all be rushing down to the GPs demanding the double dose Mem B vaccine when we don't actually need it. And that would, of course, create more problems than it solved. Although it would appear from Andrew's message that I'll share with you shortly that my fears, if that's the right word, warnings about what the online grifting community, who spent much of this decade telling blatant and obvious lies about vaccines, what they will be doing with the latest tragedy and the latest outbreak. It would appear that my fears were justified. Hi, James. I saw 2 posts on Monday, one asking for the COVID injection numbers in the area and the other blaming the outbreak on vapor trails. Good luck with those people. In fact, you remind me, Andrew, Henry Reilly will be with us shortly for today's instalment of Reilly's Reform Roundup, and it is an absolute doozy. I mean, it's extraordinary that something that began as a sort of fly-by-night or flash-in-the-pan little idea, little feature, has now been running almost uninterrupted for the best part of a month, and today's is potentially the biggest yet. In fact, why don't I do a little hook and tease on this before Henry gets here? I wonder how much money you think you would have to pay Nigel Farage in order to get him to record himself endorsing vile anti-Semitic theories. Would you have to pay him A, £760, B, £76, or C, £76,000? So if you wanted to get Nigel Farage to record himself suggesting that vile anti-Semitic conspiracy theories are actually true, would you have to pay him £7,600, 76 quid, or £76,000? Henry will have the answer to that question shortly, and we'll probably be hearing it sooner rather than later. The time now is 10:45.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
All of this criticism of the President of the United States actually only serves to protect Keir Starmer. And I wonder whether there are Labour MPs who a month or so ago would have been chomping at the bit to get rid of him, now see a war in the Middle East, a very angry President, a volatile economy, and think, not the moment. And be honest, is Angela Rayner going to have done a better job in handling Donald Trump than Keir Starmer has currently done?
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and run.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex business card. Interest, fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies and limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
Pain in my hip. I keep feeling dizzy.
I'm getting migraines more often.
There's another way to contact your GP practice, by simply sending your symptoms and requests through their website or the NHS app. We're delivering an NHS fit for the future. Tap it, type it, and we'll take care of it.
Julia, how do you spell vertebrae?
Oh, just type pain in the neck.
What's the best present you ever got for your birthday? I bet it wasn't as life-changing as £1 million. Every week with the birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1 or via post. Enter by midnight on Sunday and your special day could win you £1 million. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus UK only, no purchase necessary.
Irrational is a printer that's next to your laptop, but somehow offline. Smart is a printer with self-healing Wi-Fi that helps keep you connected. Stressful is your printer choosing check-in day to check out of ink. Smart is an HP Smart Tank with 3 years of cartridge-free ink. Oh, that's smart. So go on, search HP Smart Tank. Find the last printer you'll ever need.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
10:48 is the time. This we may need to extend this into the beginning of the next hour because the stories just keep on coming. Henry Reilly is here. I hesitate to ask, Henry, any progress on the jingle front?
Oh, there's been quite a few. They're nice and short, but I'll give you some of them. Yeah. Right, let's start. I think Keith's got Liam ready. Can we hear from Liam's entry first?
Reilly's Reform Roundup.
Which does what it says on the tin.
Yeah.
We had this from Lawrence.
Reilly
is Reform Roundup.
It sounds like Nigel Farage,
doesn't
it?
It does.
Yeah, I think it's an AI thing.
More on that later.
Graham sent this.
Riley's Reform Round.
It's good, but
what?
I think you're going to like the next one, Rasmus.
Go on.
And now, Riley's Reform Roundups.
Bernard Manning.
Well played. I still prefer Graham's.
And the last one that was sent in, although there were more, but there was just so many. And Patrick, who actually messaged you yesterday, saying, where can I send these to? Patrick sent this. It's a bit long, so we won't hear the whole thing, but this is what Patrick sent.
Right here every day. 12 inches. The extended dance remix. There's weird old Uncle Nigel. No. Keith just said in my ear 45 seconds left.
Oh, yeah. Prospector. And Henry the man himself. And it sounds like I've made this, doesn't it? Anyway, thank you. Patrick Sentry.
Any mention of whose show this happened from?
Sorry. He's the very
best. Yeah. Who is? He's the rootinest, tootinest
reporter. Yes. I'm blushing.
You are listening to the James O'Brien program on LBC. This is extraordinary. It's the rootinest, tootinest reporter. I'm going to introduce you with that every time you come to the studio from that. Well, yeah. he's the rootinest, tootinest reporter. Thank you.
Yeah.
I said thank you, Keith. Thank you. Cheers. Well, let's begin with the answer to that question. How much do you have to pay Nigel Farage to get him to record his endorsement of vile anti-Semitic conspiracy theories? Indeed, to get him to say he doesn't think they're conspiracy theories at all. Is it £7,600, £76, or £76,000? And I'm going to lean towards the latter because he is nothing if not greedy.
Well, he charged £76 for a video which has been labelled by some to contain anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, James. This is reporting from The Guardian. Their reporter Henry Dyer has done a deep dive into some of the videos that have been posted on Cameo since 2021 on Nigel Farage's account. He's made more than 4,000 videos in that time, paid for Cameo videos, and charged a total of at least £374,000, but as you say, that particular one was £76. Let's just hear, this is the message that Nigel Farage put on Cameo.
Well, Hayley, hello, it's Nigel Farage here, and John has been on to me now. You were a Brexit voter, which is a very, very good thing, but you're worried about the way the world is going. Is it a whole series of secret societies? Is it the Bilderbergers that are running the world? You know, there are many, many other theories. It could be the Masons. Some think it's the Rothschilds.
Jewish.
Maybe it's George Soros.
Jewish.
I don't know. What I do know is actually, I don't think any of it's a conspiracy theory. I think it's just Marxism that is coming back to haunt the world.
Good Lord. And of course, what we discovered when the head of the Met announced that his members were going to have to announce membership of the Masons was that the idea that the Masons is sort of secretly pulling the strings of society was also had its roots in anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. So he could have listed them all. He didn't have to say at the end that he doesn't think that they're conspiracy theories. £76.
£76 for that.
So anti-Semitic
video.
And cheap.
He charged £85 for birthday messages, Christmas or Valentine's Day messages, we are told. A spokesperson for Reform UK has said, Mr. Farage says, and this is not from the man himself, this is from a spokesperson, said, Mr. Farage has recorded many thousands of videos for genuine supporters to celebrate weddings, congratulate friends or send novelty messages. At this scale, the occasional mistake can occur.
And any word yet from Mr. Farage himself?
No, they haven't.
And just while we've got you, has he apologised yet for all the anti-Semitism that his former contemporaries at Dulwich College accused him of? The jokes about the gas chambers, the claims that Hitler was right, I think 35 of them now endorsing that story. Have we had any apology for that yet?
No, they haven't. So how do you trust anything
wrong,
you say?
Wrong. Oh, dear.
There's a lot of other videos in there, James.
Well, let's do one every day. Let's do a feature in a feature. Let's call it What He Says for Money. coins, what he'll do for coins. And we've gone to opening anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. What on earth will we would discover tomorrow that Nigel Farage will do for coins?
I'll have a look at some of the other videos. One that was not paid for, though, James, was there were some instances where the video went slightly wrong, some outtakes, as it were.
Now it's a really big moment because you are turning to our streets. Oh, for f***ing sake, go on doing what you do. Oh, for f***ing you.
So those are sort of instances that didn't make... They were sort of...
A C word in there, I think.
They may well have been, but excellently bleeped.
Well, is that you?
Yes.
Good Lord, he's a man of many talents, isn't he? He's the rootinist, tootinist reporter.
Thank you. You said it. There's a few other stories, James. So that's the first one. Number two, you'll recall I brought you on, I think it was Friday, this story that I'd uncovered of a Reform UK councillor who had said, quote, some women should have never left the kitchen at an international... Well, this was at an International Women's Day event.
It's a bit of time off from racism, doesn't it? Or anti-Semitism. So this one's misogyny.
And that event was in Northampton, made by Councillor Peter York. He has since apologised.
I'd like to take this moment to address comments I made on the International Women's Day, which has caused serious concerns. I recognise that the words I used were inappropriate and capable of causing offence. And for that, I sincerely apologise, which I have previously. Respect for women has always been a fundamental part of my life and my values.
That is Councillor Peter York, who's apologised for those remarks.
Sounds very clever. What else have you got?
There is reporting in the I newspaper with regards...
You all right? Should we play a jingle?
Can we have one of the jingles?
We play a jingle. Henry just needs to compose himself. Why are you playing this one?
Not this one.
Glass of water.
There's another... No. Well hydrated. There's another story. This is a good reporting in the I newspaper, actually, about a sort of civil war that has emerged in Doncaster, where Reform have the largest party, but there's actually a Labour mayor there. Anyway, there's this airport, Doncaster Sheffield Airport, and it's now seen rows and resignations within the Reform group. Labour want the airport to reopen. It closed in 2022. Keir Starmer, Rachel Reeves, the local mayor, Oliver Coppard, want it open. However, Reform UK have... There's been a sort of curiosity as what their position is. They have 34 councillors, but they've voiced concerns about ploughing the money back into the project and have said they would prefer private investment. They then had to call an extraordinary general meeting to establish a position on the matter. Reform wanted to raise some of their concerns, which they said they had. However, the meeting had to be abandoned after Reform councillors falsely accused council officers of changing the wording of their motion without their agreement. It turns out that the group leader there, Craig Ward, I played you a clip of him, he's the one who says it is what it is, very sort of laissez-faire approach.
Another very clever bloke.
He said he admitted that he'd not properly read the documents he received from Doncaster chief executive. So Reform had said that they'd changed the wording of the motion without their agreement. Turns out Craig Ward later admitted he hadn't actually read the documents properly before signing them off.
And they hadn't changed the wording at all. They
hadn't changed the wording. He said it was an error of judgment.
Not reading the things that he claimed had been changed.
Yes.
I suppose technically it is an error of judgment. Also, of course, it is what it is.
It's what it is. And Nikki Brown, who left Reform for Advance UK over this, that's the party led by Reform UK's former deputy leader Ben Habib, has said, I think he's a nice bloke. He does try his best. I think the main issue is his inexperience. But he's their second leader. Their previous leader, Guy Aston, had to stand down for receiving, he says he received vitriolic texts that border on abuse. Right. He was there was a previous leader.
Did he read them? Do we know that he read them, or was he following following his council leader and not reading the things that he's complaining about?
He did read the vitriolic texts over the stance.
And what's happening to the airport?
Well, the airport, the Labour wanted to, it's shut in 2022. They wanted to go ahead. I should say there was also Richard Tice is alleged to have phoned Reform councillors there telling them to push it through. Reform say there's nothing to see here. It is what it is.
It is what it is. Doncaster Labour describing the situation as a shambles.
That's right. A couple of other stories for you, James.
Please.
If you'll indulge me.
History is history, isn't it? Oh, that wasn't you, was it? Yes, George Ike was trying to eat your lunch yesterday.
It?
Did you hear this?
Yeah, I did.
Did an interview with the 12-year-old who runs the council in Warwickshire, and he said, history is history.
History is history.
History is history. That's why it's history.
Yeah.
Clever lad.
And Reform... this is Staffordshire, James, which you'll recall is one of those authorities Reform UK won. They've elected a new leader, but opposition parties have been quick to point out this is now their third leader after two racism scandals. Staffordshire County Council, Reform UK won. Martin Murray, councillor there, congratulations to him. He's the new leader. Ian Cooper was the first leader there. He had to stand down under a cloud of racism allegations linked to social media activity. Chris Large, who we've spoken about before, was then subject of an inquiry into racist posts he denied writing. He said that...
Was he hacked?
No, he said that he had a bereavement and health reasons, but that was why he stood down. But actually, it was later emerged that there were racist posts that he allegedly sent but has denied writing. And there's a standards inquiry currently going into those allegedly racist posts.
And that's today's Riley's Reform Roundup.
There's a very quick last one.
Yeah, go on. Can you get Graham's jingle ready? Because I'm actually toying with the idea of using this one regularly.
A former Northamptonshire Reform councillor who was suspended by the party has resigned after sitting as an independent. He had the whip suspended because his actions and behaviours brought Reform UK into disrepute. He hadn't spoken at the council for 6 months, which meant he automatically was in line to be sort of terminated as a councillor. He then said, I'm going to resign.
Yeah.
He didn't mean to resign.
So he resigned by accident?
He resigned by accident. Okay. He then disputed the 6 months, but they said, because you've triggered your resignation, we can't do anything about it.
But did he forget that he'd resigned, or did he not read the resignation letter that he wrote?
It would appear his workings out of the sort of six-month period,
right.
He was disputing that.
So he didn't count?
Well,
or he counted wrong.
He was unclear as to what the sort of 6 months constituted.
Is he the Shadow Chancellor, or is that the other fellow?
That's
Bob Jenrick.
Robert Jenrick. This is Councillor Adam Smith.
Councillor Adam Smith.
Who's now
ironic.
No longer a councillor.
Okay, so no longer a politician at all.
No longer a politician resigned, at all.
But then said he hadn't resigned, but the local authorities said, no, actually, you had resigned, therefore you are now resigned.
That's it. And he's disputing that, but they've made it very clear that he has resigned, and so they have to take that as he also
sounds very clever, doesn't he? And that brings us to the end of today's
Riley's Reform Roundup.
Thank you, Graham.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the number of meningitis cases in Kent has risen from 15 to 20 after an outbreak began on Friday. GPs are being advised to prescribe antibiotics to anyone who visited Club Chemistry in Canterbury between the 5th and 7th of March. All cases are currently being treated as linked to the nightclub. Ashley Cohen is a pharmacist in Leeds. She's told LBC News there's been a surge in demand for meningitis vaccines.
I can't get hold of any at all for love nor money. I've had more inquiries in 24 hours for meningitis B than I've had in the last 10 years in my pharmacy. I think what the government are doing at the moment is they're trying to quarantine supplies and stocks from manufacturers to make sure that it's pivoted and it's prioritised to the Kent area.
A targeted vaccination programme is being rolled out to students at the University of Kent. Sir Keir Starmer is expected to face more questions from MPs in the Commons this lunchtime over the UK's relationship with the US. President Trump has stepped up his criticism of Sir Keir's response to the Iran war in recent days. Mr Trump says Europe's reluctance to send ships to help unblock the Strait of Hormuz is unfair to the United States. Cabinet Office Minister Nick Thomas-Simmons has told LBC talks about potential help are ongoing.
The blockade of the Strait has a hugely adverse effect on our economy. You can already start to see it happening, the increase in the price of a barrel of oil. And people will themselves, I know, be concerned about prices at the pump. So the government is engaged in discussions both with Gulf allies and indeed allies here in the UK, and indeed Defence Secretary speaking every day to his US counterpart as well.
The Conservatives will seek to force a Commons vote on scrapping September's planned fuel duty rise. Labour says it is keeping the situation under review as oil prices continue to rise due to the war in the Middle East. Angela Rayner has warned government plans to make it harder for migrants to stay in the UK are un-British. Under the proposals, migrant workers would have to wait 10 years for permanent residence rather than 5. Refugees could face waits of 20 years. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, says the changes are needed to stop a drain on public finances. And the UK could see its warmest day of the year so far today. Temperatures are forecast to exceed 20 Celsius in the northwest of England and the northwest of Wales. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 25 at 10,429. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.15. LBC weather, sunshine for most, the odd shower for the northwest of Scotland, a mild day, a high of 20 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
I'm here with Charlie Bigham. What's cooking, Charlie?
My classic fish pie, made with succulent salmon and delicately smoked haddock, smothered with bechamel and parsley sauce, and all topped off with the richest, butteriest mash and a golden mature cheddar topping.
You had me at succulent.
An unbeatable classic. Cheers.
Delicious. Tastes like home.
You know you don't actually live here, right?
Huh. Charlie Bigham's.
Handmade in my kitchen. Cooked in yours.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 4 minutes after 11, and with the constant caveat, of course, that we will bring any developing news or breaking stories to you regarding the meningitis outbreak as and when they occur. Taking a day off today from the war in Iran, but again, if anything significant happens, then we will bring you that immediately. I think tomorrow we'll catch up with what is going on in Lebanon, attacks upon Beirut, more people being ordered by the Israeli Defense Force to leave their homes, because perhaps while the world's attention is focused on Iran, Benjamin Netanyahu believes that he can conduct operations in Lebanon that would ordinarily, well, you have to hope, raise eyebrows. But all of that in the background today, because I want to have a slightly more old-fashioned phone in about Angela Rayner's intervention today. And I want to stress a couple of things before we get stuck into this. The first is that we're talking about Angela Rayner's critique of Keir Starmer. I upset people I didn't really enjoy upsetting a month or two ago, which is a strange feeling for me, because normally the people I upset are people who I absolutely love upsetting. They're kind of people who listen to Riley's Reform Roundup and send me messages saying things like, ha ha ha, I can't believe you're drawing so much attention to them, and don't realise that what they're effectively saying is, yeah, me, I love the anti-Semitism. Give me more racism. I love misogyny. We want more examples of this, please, from our heroes. But again, as I say, not clever enough to join those particular dots. But I upset people who are hoping for the best for our country under Keir Starmer's premiership. I stand by everything I said, don't get me wrong, but I didn't enjoy upsetting you, because you pointed out that the traditional media, or the right-wing media in this country, behaves in a profoundly unfair fashion when critiquing Keir Starmer. I remember when he was found to have made a profit on a field that he bought for his dead, disabled mother so that she could look after distressed donkeys. I wish I was making this up. They attacked him for that. When they found that he had had a perfectly legal curry while campaigning somewhere in the north of England, I forget precisely where, they attacked him for that while defending Boris Johnson for essentially throwing more parties in Downing Street during the course of the lockdowns that the rest of us were doing our best to observe than Peter Stringfellow managed to throw in his entire life. That's one that the kids might have to look up. In fact, I believe one of the kids is currently looking that up. Be careful of that website. You might not want it on your search history. I mention all of this because it is Angela Rayner who has had a polite swing at Keir Starmer. So you can't attack me today, and I do occasionally care. If I've upset people that I don't want to upset and then they attack me, those attacks matter. They do actually just get under my visor. They pierce my metaphorical armour. Not too badly, because you couldn't do this for a living if you were possessed of extremely thin skin, although it turns out you can lead Reform UK, but you would obviously be slightly weird if nothing ever bothered you. So I did not enjoy upsetting what I would describe as Keir Starmer loyalists. I would not, for example, describe them as Stormtroopers, which is what some people online have done, because I think that's just rude. I want the best for this country. Keir Starmer at the last general election was clearly, by a country mile, the best possible prospect to be our Prime Minister. And for many of us, he remains so from the currently available candidates. But the currently available candidates don't include other members of the Labour Party, because they would not, as things stand, be fighting the next general election. And I just want to stress all of that, because the conversation that I want to have is framed by Angela Rayner's description of Labour as running out of time to change course. Now, you don't have to agree with the Daily Telegraph when they describe it as a direct challenge to Sir Keir Starmer's leadership, although I think you'd struggle not to agree that it is her strongest criticism of the Prime Minister to date, an exhortation to change direction or face defeat at the ballot box isn't necessarily a leadership challenge, but it is a challenge to leadership. You see the distinction, clearly. You see the difference. And, of course, with the local elections coming up in May, the possibility of a leadership challenge is going to get greater from now to then. And what she has said is, as a party and a movement, we cannot hide. We cannot just go through the motions in the face of decline. There's no safe ground for us, and we're running out of time. The change that people wanted so desperately to see needs to be seen. It needs to be felt, and we have to show that it's a Labour government that will deliver it. And many of you in this room will deliver that for us. Our party is your party. And we have to come together in the face of division and hate and make sure that the Labour Party represents the ordinary working people of this country. And I'm in there with you, so I can't wait to get involved with you. And what it means is that Angela Rayner, who was Keir Starmer's choice for deputy leader and would still be in that role were it not for mistakes that she made when applying for a mortgage to buy her home in Brighton, mistakes that did breach the ministerial code, but in a very specific and limited way, I think, is the phrase that you'd use. What I think Laurie Magnus found was that she hadn't knowingly done anything wrong, but given her status and position, she should have worked harder to be 100% sure that she had not done anything, that she had not unknowingly done anything wrong. Does that fit with your recollections of the moment? She hadn't knowingly done anything wrong, but she had done something wrong, and given her status and her ministerial position, she should have worked harder to establish beyond doubt that she hadn't unknowingly done anything wrong. And that's why she's no longer deputy Labour leader. She is, however, the favourite to replace Keir Starmer in the event of a challenge. And this was at a meeting of a group called Mainstream that was launched last September in the face of Labour's poll ratings and Andy Burnham's declaration that he had been urged by rebel MPs to challenge Sir Keir for the leadership. So the phone-in that I want to have with you today is, and I'm going to really stress that she's swinging at Keir Starmer quite politely. She's swinging at Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, rather more robustly, I would argue. But she's not, by any stretch of the imagination, trying to undermine him. I don't believe. You can disagree. 03456060973. She talks about how he should be proud, not embarrassed by Labour's values. She talks about how the public have the impression that we've defended the status quo rather than challenged it. And when she says we, she means Labour. That we, Labour, have represented the establishment, not working people. And at worst, we became it, i.e. the establishment. The renters' rights reforms that she steered to almost completion are among Labour's achievements in government, says Angela Rayner. And as she points out, there's no point in people like me reeling off lists like this in rooms like this because it hasn't cut through with the public, which brings me back to my inbox, which is often full of lists of things that Labour have achieved. But the point Angela Rayner makes, not me, the point Angela Rayner makes is that it doesn't matter. If we're all just passing around crib sheets of Labour's achievements and the public are not responding to them, the polls are not demonstrating an understanding of, for example, I think that the concerns about the NHS are the lowest they've been now in a good few years. It was published yesterday. Another story that was out yesterday, can I get some details on this? I kept meaning to mention it and I forgot, was that the air in London is now... The estimate taken of how long it would take to get the air in London as safe as it is today was decades. And they've done it in years. The Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has done it in years. These are stories that in a normal country would be celebrated. But in a weird Brexit, based country where an awful lot of members of the political establishment seem to be almost as racist now as Billy Buncher Numbers on Twitter with the bulldog avatar, because Sadiq Khan is the Mayor of London, many people won't be aware of these breakthroughs and that story. So the polling shows that the cost of living is a much bigger problem to the public than anything else. Immigration is still in second place, unless you ask people what affects them directly, in which case immigration falls down the list at a rate of knots. And the NHS is dropping all the time, as in people are more and more satisfied with the NHS in general and with their specific experiences of the NHS at a local level. So I think things are now, in March of 2026, partly as a consequence of his leadership over the Iran issue, and partly as a consequence of things bedding in, are going okay. They're going quite well for Keir Starmer. It hasn't really been reflected in many polls for party level, but he remains the person that a plurality of the electorate would prefer to see as prime minister compared to any of the current rivals. So they want him to... it's close. I think Farage is in second and Badenoch is 48th. But the numbers are there for him, not for the party. So there's something weird going on because his approval ratings are very low as a politician. And yet when you ask who is best suited to be prime minister this week, he's top of the pile. And the party is slipping into third, even potentially fourth place in some of the opinion polls. So it is a right old mess. And yet I think that things are actually this week, this month, going better than they have almost since the winter fuel story set the tone for the first innings of the Labour government, for the first innings of this particular test match. So what I want you to tell me, and the number you need is 0345 6060973, is whether or not Angela Rayner is right. There's two questions I want you to answer. Is Labour running out of time to change course? 0345 6060973. And crucially, what should the new course be? So if you answer yes to the first question, you have to answer the second question. If you answer no to the first question, you have to answer a different question. You just have to tell me why you don't think Labour's, why you think that, what you think Labour is getting right, why you think Labour is doing okay. Okay? 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. And the former deputy leader of the Labour Party, and deputy prime minister, so being deputy leader of the Labour Party is, of course, in the gift of the membership, but being deputy prime minister is not. That is an appointment made by the prime minister, in this case, Sir Keir Starmer. When she says that Labour is running out of time, what do you think she is talking about? And do you think she is correct? And I should probably answer those questions myself, shouldn't I? Because I've been in too many phone-ins lately where I leave all the heavy lifting to you. And you know what I nearly said then? And my answer is, I don't know. I thought you're supposed to get more pungent in your opinions as you get older. You're supposed to get more set in your ways. You're supposed to get more stubborn in your views. I'm experiencing the opposite. So I'm becoming a bit less certain about that. I mean, not some things. Donald Trump is a blithering idiot. In fact, do you know what is on the front page of Private Eye this week after we dedicated the opening of yesterday's programme to wondering why more people don't just call him a deranged liar, because he clearly is. And then, lo and behold, Private Eye drops through my letterbox this morning alongside The New World, of which more later, and it has got Donald Trump on the phone to Keir Starmer saying, I need help, and Keir Starmer responding, I know you do, you nutter. Or words to that effect. So, admittedly, it's a satirical organ, but it is at least acknowledging that more people should be pointing out that Donald Trump is, to use their word, a nutter. A nutter with an N. He's also a nutter, word I can't say on the radio without upsetting Ofcom. And indeed, We'll be looking at some of the attendant problems Ofcom currently faces in a later part of the programme after PMQs. But here it is, okay? I think they're doing well. I think, but the problem is I also hope that the course he's plotted over Iran has changed the way people look at Keir Starmer and actually given him a statesmanship status that he had in opposition, but which he had managed to perhaps lose grip of, not squander, but he'd managed to lose grip of it in power. I saw him this week not only essentially telling Donald Trump to take a running jump, but also the way in which he greeted Volodymyr Zelensky at Downing Street yesterday. We have a prime minister for the first time probably since... I'll give David Cameron a break here. We have a prime minister who looks like a world leader. We didn't have a prime minister who looks like a world leader when Theresa May was holding Donald Trump's hand in Washington. We didn't have a prime minister who looked like a world leader when Boris Johnson was in Downing Street. Although he got Ukraine right. Hey, and do you remember what happened when he got Ukraine right? Do you remember what Keir Starmer did? Absolutely four square behind the prime minister and behind the government on this. And you try and work out what on earth Kemi Badenoch has done over the Iran question, and frankly, you'll be here all day trying to work out what her position is, and indeed, we'd probably need the ferret sound effect as well, Keith, at some point, because I think she's done a triple reverse, she's done a triple or a quadruple reverse ferret now, the leader of the opposition, all of which sets up quite an interesting PMQs. But Angela Rayner is sounding the alarm on Labour's current position. Is she right to do so? And if so, why? If not, of course, why not? 0345 6060 973 is the number that you need. Angela Rayner warns that Labour is running out of time. Is she right? And if she's right, what should they do about it? Or do you, like me, think that Keir Starmer has actually earned himself a little bit of breathing space and that Angela Rayner should probably have rethought her plans to deliver this speech this week? I think that's probably where I am, actually. Given the events of the last 2 weeks, Angela Rayner probably should have waited a while before delivering this speech, if indeed she decided that it was still a speech that she wanted to deliver. But I could be wrong, OK? 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
This is 40-year-old Kathy, mother of two and self-confessed tele-addict.
Ready? Oh, look at you. That's brilliant. Well done.
This is also Kathy, working as part of a team to keep things calm at her local prison.
Listen, speak to me.
And helping someone's son write his first letter home in 8 months.
Well done. You should be really proud.
Thank you, miss.
An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
The famous five were boarding the train, ready for their next great Western adventure. Who knew Wales and the Southwest had so many myths and legends, said Anne. Such amazing stories. King Arthur's Camelot, the Giants of Avon Gorge, the Hound of the Baskervilles.
Oh, I do like listening to a good tale, said George excitedly. You're good at telling tales too, teased Dick.
Great Western Railway. Legendary adventures start here.
At Nuffield Health, we're more than just a gym. We're a place to swim and a place to join in. We're a place to work out and a place to spin. We're a place to relax and take it all in. There are so many ways to enjoy being a member of Nuffield Health. With saunas, steam rooms, pools and hundreds of classes, we're more than just a gym. Get more from your membership. Join today at nuffieldhealth.com. Facilities vary. Check locally for details.
Down.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
22 minutes after 11, Angela Rayner suggesting that Labour is running out of time and, crucially, I think, I should have hit this phrase a little bit harder, needs to change course. Labour needs to change course. I want you to tell me what course you think Labour should be following. If, of course, you agree with with Keir Starmer. The number you need is 0345 60 60 973. And I don't think you indulge me a little bit, but the reason why I was at great pains to stress that this is a critique coming from Angela Rayner, not from the right-wing media and not from me, is because I want the people who were very cross with me a couple of months ago when I suggested that Keir Starmer had probably blown it. I've resiled from that position now. I'm very glad I used the probably. I think he's having a very good month. But when I suggested a month or two ago that he was very, very, very close to game over, and that May would probably prove to be the final nail in the coffin of his leadership, I upset an awful lot of people who want the best for this country and think that Keir Starmer is the man to deliver it. So you can join in this conversation in a more meaningful way than just sending me messages calling me a meanie, which did, you know, I did register that and I did understand. I disagreed with you, but respectfully, as opposed to the other people that I routinely disagree with who I don't respect because they're racists. It's 23 minutes after 11 and Sean is in Birmingham. Sean, what made you pick up the phone?
Yeah, this is interesting because I've sort of been waiting.
It's the first time for everything, Sean. I've been doing this for 20 years, you know.
No, this particular story. So, just to make clear before I go into it and yes. start, giving a little attack to Starmer, I am very much aware of the wins. I'm also aware of the U-turns. So,
yes.
But the problem that I see, and I think this is what Angela Rayner is identifying, is what we're getting at the moment, you know, some people say Tory light. I feel like it's Labour light as well, in a sense. But
yes.
We're getting some bare minimum policies. So two child caps done, great. Free breakfast clubs for kids, great. Renters' rights act, great. But the big problem is and this comes down to what she was saying about the establishment as well.
Mm.
What have Labour done in 2 years, and what was in their manifesto that is going to deliver an improvement to people's material conditions in the 99%, so these working people? And just to caveat it, so I'm on just under a median wage. I'm 25.
Yeah.
And when I look at what this Labour government have done, and I understand the situation and how they look at the economy as to why they've done it, but pension contributions that I pay in, that's going to be taxed from, I think, 2028. The thresholds aren't moving. I know they're going to do this stuff with energy bills, but the Iran war has sort of meant that we're
that's
not...
That's all up in the air, isn't it? That's all,
yeah.
And if there were incremental improvements in the cost of living on the way, they're probably up in the air now as well, through no fault of theirs.
And this is the problem. And when the facts change your mind. But I think on top of that, when the facts change in regards to the economic picture, you need to change your policy. And Labour haven't been reactive in that sense to take the action that people are going to feel. And that is why they're in such a poor position in the polls. That is why...
What could they have done differently then? Because, I mean, listen, some of this is textbook. And some of it, I hope, is a little bit more thoughtful than some of the obvious points.
Yeah.
The first is the dire straits that the country faces, partly as a consequence of austerity, partly as a consequence of Liz Truss, partly as a consequence of COVID, magnified by the mismanagement and the of COVID by Johnson and his mate. So there is a need for dreadful word. I love this word actually, but it's prudence. There is a need for prudence, and prudence means you can't just write checks for the people that you care most about. So what would the new course contain that is both plausible and substantive?
Well, this is the big thing, isn't it? So what I don't like is simple solutions to complex problems. So I'm going to just outline it very vaguely to start with. But what we need and what we saw with austerity is public services have been underfunded. Taxes have continued to not be put where they need to. All of these tax loopholes.
But where do you think the taxes are going instead?
It's not about... I don't think the issue is that we're overspending. I think it's perhaps that initially, for the investment that we need and to make the change that we need, we're probably underspending. But it's understandable.
Well, that means taxes go up or stay up.
Well, this is the question. It's who it goes up on.
Okay.
So, as I said to the producer, I'm sort of Green supporter. So, you know, wealth taxes, capital gains tax in line with income tax, those seem like decent starting points as part of a wider policy picture to look at it. And obviously I'm not expecting the Labour government to copy and paste a Green manifesto, because there are different, you know, directions, but I feel like they do need to target more. So, you know, windfall taxes they were talking about on the energy companies.
Yes.
what I think we are aware of what the problems were with austerity. Things aren't funded properly, and also everything's been privatised and it's cost us an arm and a leg. So
yes,
there are things that could be done. So further nationalisation and quicker nationalisation of our, you know, key components.
So they came to power. And, you know, a manifesto is always a wish list as opposed to a manual for government, despite, of course, people will always be desperate to pretend otherwise, and some people probably believe otherwise, but it's a wish list and promises that some will be kept, some will be broken. It's not a technical manual that will define every twist and turn of a premiership, because as you began your call by pointing out, there'll be a lot of things that you can't predict or you can't see coming from a mile away, or that you don't know until you actually get into the room where it happens. But I worry, and I'll level with you, because you sound like a clever bloke, I worry that we are turning the wealth tax into a money tree, into a holy grail.
I get
and
that.
Do you know what I mean? And I haven't.
What I would say is I'm very aware of the figures. It's what, 10 to 20 billion, which is in the sense of government expenditure.
Well, I mean, that's best case scenario. And as you point out, even then, it's not going to touch the sides of all of the things that you and I would both like to see better funded.
This is it. But I think we also need an honest conversation, which is, if you want public services that work, potentially we do need to pay more into it. Because I think what people don't recognise enough at the moment is the reason everyone's so angry about paying tax at the moment is because nothing works. You are paying, and what are you getting? Obviously, we've spoke about the improvements in the NHS, but I mean, I'm in Birmingham, so we've got potholes, the bins haven't been collected this week, and it's the fundamentals that are missing, and you don't have to be politically engaged to think, well, that's frustrating, why aren't the government doing something about that? And of course, we won't get into the Birmingham bin strike situation, it's wider than that.
Yeah.
But it's little things like that across the country that people are thinking, I'm paying all of this, and they're more aware of what they're paying because things are so tight and continue to get tighter, that, you know, people need to see some improvement, whether that is within their cost of living or in, you know, the services that they get for their tax.
And of course that does two things, because if they do see a measurable improvement in their quality of life, then the invitation to blame all the problems on immigrants becomes less attractive as well. We know that a happier a population is, the less susceptible they are to racist politicians.
Yeah, and I think the risk, and I think what Angela Rayner was talking about specifically with indefinite leave to remain, she made some comments on them. I interpret that as her essentially saying, it's a bit long-winded, but if you can't beat them, you don't join them, you try harder to beat them.
And yeah, I thought it might be a bit too anarchy to go in hardest on this hour, but I mean, Shabana Mahmood is more in her sights than Keir Starmer in this speech, I think.
Yeah, and this is the thing, but I think the way I look at it is we're 2 years in now. If they're going to change course, they need to do it quick, because how long do things take to get through government House of Lords? If you want to do anything, you've got to get the ball rolling now. They can't afford to stand around waiting. And, you know, like I say, I understand government is tricky, but there needs to be quicker reactions to the change in economic
circumstances. I'm standing by my observation that you're a clever bloke, but I think you may have got the pension stuff wrong. I think that quite a few people have been in touch to say it's only going to be higher earners who are going to have their pension contributions taxed, but you sound like someone who is usually across the details.
I'm a bit of a while with the budget. Yeah, I'm sure I worked out that if I was putting into my pension what I should be, which I think I'm about, from around 2028, it would be taxed. So as much as I would agree, I'd be very happy for it to just be on, you know, higher earners. Mm.
Same.
To a point.
And I'm one of them.
it would get to a point where working people are going to be paying, even if it is just a little amount, it's like at the time when you're saying...
Well, someone will clarify that, no doubt. But before I let you go, because I'm a bit late for the news, we haven't mentioned Iran. Is it not featuring in your thinking?
No, it definitely is. So, I think we all want a break from the Iran coverage, but it was very much his response. What I must say on the reactive side of things, I did listen to his response on the oil situation the other day, and I thought, actually, that's really decent as a starting point. And I think if he could approach everything like that as quickly, that'd be great. And I think that's probably why what you were saying about who's the best prime minister right now, based on the polling,
I can understand
why people are saying that.
Imagine having Badenoch or Farage in the chair when Donald Trump rings and says, give me everything I want, and they just fight with each other over who's going to give him most or give him more.
That's that's it. So I think people are seeing that, at least on this one, it feels like he's got the British interests at heart, and I think that's what people need to see more of. And when I say British interest, like I say, that's that working people, that 99% that need to see that there is something for this government, for them, that's going to impact
them.
Your
hat,
something to shout really loud about that as well.
Something to hang your hat on. Thank you, mate. I could listen to you all day. Have I told you that before?
I'll take it. Thank you.
You're a brilliant communicator, and it's not as easy as you make it sound. I know that, and you really you think about things properly, and you express yourself with incredible clarity. I'm very lucky to have you listening to the program, let alone ringing in, Sean.
I appreciate it. Well,
take care. Seriously, it's and we'll try and find out the exact detail of that pension situation for you as well. 11:33 is the time, and Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
The number of meningitis cases in Kent has risen from 15 to 20 after an outbreak began on Friday. GPs are being advised to prescribe antibiotics to anyone who visited Club Chemistry in Canterbury between the 5th and 7th of March. In the past hour, Israel has announced that it's killed Iran's intelligence minister Ismail Hatib in overnight strikes. Tehran is yet to comment. And Keir Starmer is expected to face more questions from MPs in the Commons shortly over the UK's relationship with the US. President Trump has stepped up his criticism of Keir's response to the conflict in the Middle East in recent days. You can hear Prime Minister's questions live and in full with James here on LBC from midday. The LBC weather, sunshine for most, the odd shower for northwestern areas of Scotland, a very mild day for some, a high of 20 degrees.
This is LBC.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 991234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
How does a $20 golf gadget end up being used as a bomb detector in war zones worldwide? I'm Alice Levine, and this is Explosive Lies, the podcast exposing a scam that fooled governments and security services across the globe. Open our free Global Player app and search Explosive Lies to start listening today.
Go all Irish to France with great low prices. With Irish Ferries, you can for less less. Irish Ferries, see you travel differently. T's and C's apply.
Serious about the right vitamins for you and your family? Trust Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company, for expert nutritional care for every age and lifestyle. Vitamins for everyone, including well man, well woman, well baby and well kid. From Boots, pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see Vitabiotics.com.
It's the last chance to get yourself a ticket for tonight's lotto draw.
It could be you.
Lotto. From the National Lottery. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. They will affect how you manage your tenancies. Act now. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting is changing.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
11:36 is the time. I do like this conversation, and if I didn't like it, then Sean's contribution would have brought me squarely into a position of liking it. But I do have some other stuff that I want to bring to your attention as well, not least an extraordinary lapse in journalistic standards at the Daily Telegraph, who, of course, still congratulating themselves over that very strange story about the re-edit of a panorama to change the order in which Donald Trump said things. But that's on the way. I've also, I mean, before PMQs, we should probably reflect upon how hard it is to work out what Cammie Badenoch thinks about Keir Starmer's response to Donald Trump's war in Iran. Because I kid you not, this isn't AI. This is the latest.
I'm Keir Starmer's biggest critic. There's a lot of stuff that I believe that he's done wrong. But the words coming from the White House are completely wrong. I think it's actually quite childish. there is a lot that can be said behind closed doors. We've got President Zelensky in our country today. The Western alliance having an argument with itself, I think, sends the wrong signal to our opponents in Iran or in Russia. We need to be strengthening the relationship between the UK and the US, irrespective of who is president or who is prime minister. But I think those words coming from the White House were childish.
Any idea what she's actually saying there? I mean, given that we were supposed to support Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu completely at the beginning of this outbreak, I genuinely have absolutely no idea what she was saying, except that behind closed doors, she could say things that she can't say out in the open, which is a very odd position for a leader of the opposition to take, because they can say whatever they want behind closed doors. Also, Keir Starmer, for all his faults, some of which we are discussing, has not actually insulted Donald Trump at any point. He has walked a diplomatic tightrope, for good or for ill, because I think with 2020 hindsight, we'd probably agree that there is no point trying to butter him up because he won't remember and he won't care, except in that very specific moment where they're leading him around King Charles's garden in a special golden carriage and making him feel like Cinderella. But even by the time he's on the plane home, all of that goodwill has been squandered. All of that goodwill has dissipated. So there's no point sucking up to him because he won't care or notice. And in fact, of course, when you move it onto a much more serious diplomatic level, even if it's a brilliant ally, a historical ally, and you have a great relationship, then you might just tweak things slightly to be more supportive than you would be in an objective universe. So an American prime president comes to a British prime minister and says, we want your help in a Middle Eastern war. If you're Tony Blair and he's George W. Bush and you're up for the war, you might play a little bit fast and loose with international law or with justifications, although don't forget they were desperate to get the UN resolution. They really did believe in those days that you can't just start a war on a whim. And because with Donald Trump, even if you were to do that, he wouldn't care. It wouldn't be worth it. There'd be no quo. It would be all quid. I just find her position hilarious. And because she's the first leader of the Tory party not to be prime minister since 2010, I'm letting myself just laugh. Normally, if you're trying to laugh at Liz Truss, you are then remember your mortgage. You're trying to laugh at Boris Johnson, and then you remember all the people who died. You laugh at Theresa May, and then you remember that she thought she could deliver Brexit. You remember Rishi Sunak? I suppose history will probably be kind. Actually, history will just forget him, won't it? It won't be kind to him at all. In much the same way that I managed to forget Joe Biden yesterday, so pot kettle. But you can laugh at Kemi Badenoch because her stupidity, her obvious stupidity, is not actually impacting upon how the country is run. And as I said a moment ago, I have no idea what she thinks about this war in Iran. And that's fine, because nor does she, which is why PMQs should be interesting today. 20 to 12 is the time. Speaking of PMs, Angela Rayner suggests Keir Starmer needs to change course. I want to know whether you think she's right, and indeed, if she is, what that new course should look like. Chris is in Bedford. Chris, what would you like to say?
Oh, good morning, James. Hello. We're back on topic. Yeah.
This topic, yes. Oh, you mean after my little foray? Well, Kemi Badenoch is on topic, I suppose, if we're talking about British politics. But, yeah, you steer us back to the straight and narrow, Chris, if you will.
No. Yeah, I'll try. But just basically, the Telegraph, by the way, yes. I have their feed on my social media.
This is not on topic. How dare you come on the radio and accuse me of being, with my undiagnosed neurodiversity, accuse me of being easily distracted and then start talking about something completely different?
Okay, but I am following Sean, and that's a difficult thing to do.
So yes, that's true.
Here's the thing, several things.
Go on.
Just get the Telegraph out of the way. My in-laws take the Telegraph.
Do they?
And they have a very narrow world view, and I keep it on my social media just for comedy value.
Yes.
So we'll leave them. The new owners might
Well, I can't now. But now you've started now. You know what I'm like. You've poked the Russian bear. You've poked the Brentford bear. And now I have to come back at you, and I have to say, actually, their coverage of the war on the news pages has been brilliant. They've got a bloke called Memphis Barker, which sounds like he should be a blues singer, not a foreign correspondent. But some of the news coverage in the Daily Telegraph, the foreign desk, and the Defence Department have been doing fantastic coverage of what's going on with regards to Iran. But then, of course, you reach the opinion pages, and it's Mr. Blobby and Ronald McDonald.
It's the Camillas and the Annabellas, this kind of finishing school columnists that they trot out.
That's what I mean. That's the opinion pages. But anyway, you see, you've done it now. No one knows what we're talking about. What if someone's just turned the radio on? They don't know what's going on now.
Well, none of us know what's going on.
That's
but
true.
Changing course. Let's get focus. Focus. No, he shouldn't change course. It's the thing about Starmer, I've said this to you before, he's dull. He's John Major rebooted.
Yes.
And what we need right now is exactly that. And the other point that's related is that it's not a popularity contest at this stage. The Labour Party, the direction of travel, needs to be maintained until possibly 12 to 18 months before the next election, at which point they come out and they start listing all the stuff they've achieved, all the stuff they're on course to achieve. And it's a big risk, I accept, but that's the only way forward. Otherwise, we just go back to this yo-yo politics, which doesn't fix the underlying problems that we face in this country.
What is the course, then? I mean, because when I was very negative towards Starmer a couple of months ago, and I've mellowed since then. Because
I hope so, too.
Well, but not completely, and probably not irreversibly, but I do struggle to describe Starmerism, if you want to use that word, what it is that he is, the umbrella under which all of his ambitions and policies would sit. What's that umbrella called?
Well, it's a woolly umbrella. I'm not sure woolly umbrellas
get the rain off you.
Well, I no, but then you see, I think what they're trying to achieve in an overall sense is difficult to define. It's the big picture. I mean, Sean said about potholes. Potholes and bin collections are for local authorities, not for government. And subtlety is everything. You've got to do it, and you've got to do it carefully. And if you U-turn on stuff, those are called adjustments. And that is intelligent. That's listening to feedback.
I know. But what about the other bit of Rayner's analysis, which would be the independent leave to remain stuff, which is more, if you take negative policies directed at refugees and foreign workers as being right-wing, which I think most of us agree these days it is. I don't know that it used to be that black and white. It used to be perfectly possible to be a fully paid-up member of One Nation Conservatives and be very warm and welcoming to to both foreign workers, foreign-born workers, and the most vulnerable people on the planet. But those boats have sailed. Shabana Mahmood's policies are further to the right of anything that the last four Tory leaders have done.
Yes, I agree. And I'm not calling in to support every single thing they stand for. I'm a socialist. I've said this before. I'm a socialist. I'm a business owner and a socialist.
I remember.
Which is a slightly conflicting thing, but
yeah, slightly.
But it can work. It can work. And I think you misunderstand Starmer's basic philosophy.
You can tell me I misunderstand it, and then you can't tell me what it is, which is a little bit having your cake and eating it, Chris.
No. Well, having your cake and eating it. Yes.
True.
But his stickability is such that he'll take all the kicking you can throw at him, and at the end of the day, I think he's going to arrive in 2029 having done enough to be re-elected and continue the good work.
That's if he gets there, because May is going to be a big test, isn't it?
No, it isn't.
No, it is.
It's an irrelevant.
But it is a big test. I mean, everybody in the Labour movement is talking about it, and there are knives being sharpened and bids being prepared. So you might not like that, but that's just a fact.
But he'll shrug his shoulders at that. And carry on. I'll guarantee I'll have a side bet with you on that.
No, I'm not allowed to. It's Ofcom rules.
Well, it's only not money. We'll go for something, I don't know, Eccles cakes or something.
You have to sing a jingle. You have to sing a jingle for Henry Reilly. You've got to sing a jingle for Henry Reilly if the... If May is a disaster and there aren't machinations that threaten Keir Starmer's leadership, then you'll have to sing a jingle. Thank you, Chris. 11:46 is the time. I think, am I allowed to agree with both callers, even though they disagreed with each other? I think I am. I think I lean towards Chris, but that might be exhaustion. It's just that ran through that list of former leaders. Osborne and Cameron shut everything down that was looking after people who most needed looking after. And Theresa May came in and the psychodrama of Brexit defined every single day of her premiership. And the idiots responsible for Brexit took over the asylum, in the case of Boris Johnson and his mates. Was Marc Francois in government then? Who put Marc Francois in government? I mean, you look back upon, I think he's back on the front bench, isn't he, Marc Francois? Good Lord, I don't know why he always puts me in mind of Ken Dodd's Diddy Men. But anyway, then you had Boris Johnson, then you had Liz Truss, and then you had Rishi Sunak, who didn't really do anything. And so that's why I think Chris got me when he talked about the hokey cokey or whatever word he used to describe the constant revolving door of politics. I just give the idea of having another rethink now. But then he can't tell me what the philosophy is. Is it a fairer society, as Mariam suggests in a text? I don't know. And then Chris points out all of the stuff. Sean, I beg your pardon, down in Broome, points out all the things that are, or up in Broome, to be precise, all the things that are not happening that perhaps people thought would happen. So Angela Rayner says they need to change course. If you are going to reject or endorse the idea that they need to change course, you have to tell me what the old course was and what the new course would be. It's 11:48.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
This is a shameful, this is a shambles.
Straight to the point.
How was that allowed to happen?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Show some evidence, Minister.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
This is 40-year-old Kathy, mother of two and self-confessed telly addict.
Oh, look at you. That's brilliant. Well done.
This is also Kathy, working as part of a team to keep things calm at her local prison.
Listen, speak to me.
And helping someone's son write his first letter home in 8 months.
Well done. You should be really proud.
Thank you, miss.
An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search Prison Jobs now.
Interactive Investor would like to say welcome and thank you. Welcome to all our new investors who joined us over the past few months. And thank you to a certain competitor that decided to change their fee structure and sent them all our way. Visit Interactive Investor to see what you could save with our low flat fee. Interactive Investor. I think, therefore I. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk.
At Kia, we know that inspiration begins with a first. Your first job, your first love, your first home. Now it's time for your first drive in the new Kia EV2 at our first drive weekends. It's your chance to be one of the first to test drive the Kia EV2 with its innovative technology and elegant eye-catching design. It's small in size, but big in personality. Discover what driving electric really means. Search Kia First Drive Weekends to reserve your place today.
Kia, movement that inspires.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. Or wobbly, or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thames Link Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
Pain in my hip. I keep feeling dizzy. I'm getting migraines more often.
There's another way to contact your GP practice, by simply sending your symptoms and requests through their website or the NHS app. We're delivering an NHS fit for the future. Tap it, type it, and we'll take care of it.
Julia, how do you spell vertebrae?
Oh, just type pain in the neck.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
It's 11:51. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Some quick catch-ups with events on the other side of the Atlantic, which are, of course, getting more bonkers all the time. So here's the thing. There was quite a significant resignation yesterday in Washington, D.C., from a historical Trump supporter, a strong and passionate supporter of Donald Trump, his counter-terrorism chief, a chap called Joe Kent, whose history is, I would say, questionable personally, and whose claims that Israel was behind everything from the war in Iran, which is, probably a defensible position, but still a debatable one. But the idea that it was that the war in Iraq was as a direct consequence of Israeli intervention looked perilously close to the sort of anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that you can get Nigel Farage to endorse on Cameo in return for £76. But he did resign, and it is embarrassing. And what I've got for you is a little question, because here is Donald Trump talking about the counterterrorism chief who resigned in yesterday in protest at the war in Iran, describing it quite correctly as posing no imminent threat to our nation, and suggesting that the foolish mistake would make Americans less safe. So here's Trump's response to that.
Well, I read his statement. I always thought he was a nice guy, but I always thought he was weak on security, very weak on security. I didn't know him well, but I thought he seemed like a pretty nice guy. It's a good thing that he's out, because he said that Iran was not a threat. Iran was a threat. Every country realized what a threat Iran was. The question is whether or not they wanted to do something about it.
So guess who appointed him? The bloke who Donald Trump said he didn't think he didn't really know him very well, and he didn't think he was very good on security. Who do you think appointed the counter-terrorism chief, Joe Kent, head of counter-terrorism in Donald Trump's administration, who Donald Trump felt wasn't very good at secure? I mean, should we make a list of things you should be good at if you're going to be the head of counter-terrorism? I've got a suggestion. I'm going to put security on that list. And Donald Trump doesn't think this guy's very good at security, but he's the counter-terrorism chief. I wonder if you've worked it out yet. Can we play just the beginning of the last clip that we played? Just a short little snatch of something? Because you'll never guess who appointed him as counter-terrorism chief.
Well, I read his statement. I always thought he was a nice guy, but I always thought he was weak on security.
So I appointed him counter-terrorism chief.
I didn't know him well, but I thought...
So I appointed him counter-terrorism chief.
It's a good thing that he's out, because
I appointed him counter-terrorism chief.
Iran was a threat.
And his own intelligence, of course, has found that Iran is not a threat. And if you were reading Jonathan Powell's comments to one newspaper this morning, you'd know that he had been there as the negotiations continued. He's Britain's national security advisor, by the way, and therefore, hopefully, somebody that the Prime Minister thinks is good at security, as opposed to Donald Trump's counter-terrorism chief, who Donald Trump felt wasn't good at security. He believed, Jonathan Powell, that progress had been made in Geneva in late February, and that the deal proposed by Iran was surprising in a good way. In other words, he thought that a deal had been reached that would end the possibility of conflict and bring a return of the peace that Barack Obama had successfully negotiated on the nuclear front before Donald Trump, during his first term, decided to blow the whole thing up. And this has been confirmed by three sources, one saying that Jonathan Powell was in the building at Oman's ambassadorial residence in Geneva, acting as an advisor. And, Donald Trump was represented by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and by Steve Witkoff. So the report today is that the offer made by Tehran on its nuclear program was significant enough to prevent a rush to war. And then, of course, we had a rush to war. So this actually happened in the Oval Office yesterday. I think this is quite important. I'm going to run out of time because Natasha's just come in, which means PMQs is on the way. But, two stories. Pete Hegseth attacking the press pack for being too unfair on Donald Trump. And you think, well, that couldn't happen here, at least. Even with our bent and corrupt Brexit-supporting media, they wouldn't actually be as craven or as dodgy as that. So you need to pay attention here to what Donald Trump is saying in the Oval Office.
BBC took it a step further. They actually had, they put words in my mouth, and they said I said some pretty bad things, and I didn't say them. It was AI generated. And I said, I never said that. In fact, some of my people said, wow, that was pretty bad stuff you said. I said, what did I say? You know, I'm pretty good at this stuff. I mean, if you can go through years of these press conferences, and you're a popular president of the United States that won in a landslide, that won all seven swing states, that got record numbers of votes. I mean, so I guess I'm okay at this stuff. I said, I never said that. And then we found out it was AI generated. And they admit they made a mistake. BBC. But I watched them this morning for some crazy reason, and it was so inaccurate. Their reporting on the war was unbelievable. We have
what he
decimated
said
that country.
I don't think we need to hear anymore.
BBC,
we're also going to run out of time. But but what I needed you to pick up on there was that he claimed that the BBC's panorama thing was AI generated. That's a lie. And not for the first time with Donald Trump. I don't know whether he's too stupid to realise the truth or whether he knows that he's lying. The Daily Telegraph reported on this story today, and I have asked a famous actor to mock up, without doing an accent, because that wouldn't be fair, to mock up Donald Trump's words. So according to the Daily Telegraph's front page today, this is what Donald Trump said in the Oval Office.
It's corrupt, fraudulent, and if you watch BBC, it's almost like they're fighting us to a draw. It was very inaccurate news. It was fake news. So I'm very proud of the term fake news because it was my term. I came up with it, but it's no longer accurate. It really is. It's corrupt, fraudulent news. It really is. It's fraudulent. It's not just fake. It's beyond fake. It's really criminal what they do.
So they didn't mention the AI bit. So the Daily Telegraph have reported what Donald Trump said in the Oval Office yesterday, and they have removed from the transcript the single most significant bit, which was when he lied about it being AI generated. And of course, what the Daily Telegraph did was propel the story originally about the BBC re-editing Donald Trump to make him look as if he had said things more close to each other than he actually had, as if it was the biggest crime since Watergate. And there they are, on their own front page, removing, in my view, the single most significant bit of yesterday's comments entirely from their coverage. And not for the first time. I do wonder sometimes whether I'm the only person who cares about this stuff. It is 11:58. Natasha Clark is here to tee up PMQs. Do you know what Kemi Badenoch's current position is on the war in Iran?
Does anybody?
Does Kemi?
I don't think she does. I mean, obviously, we are in, what, week three of this now, of this Iran conflict.
Week three.
Week three. It's probably inappropriate to create some kind of jingle. But I think, obviously, Iran will come up again. Will she do what she did last week and talk about fuel duty? Because the Conservatives have got this Opposition Day debate later on where they're trying to push a vote on that they think the fact that the government is not extending the fuel duty cut beyond September, even though, as Keir Starmer said last week, they are just not taking any decisions on that. They're going to keep it under review. Might she have another crack at that again? I think the only other political story in town today is that of Angela Rayner, so you've been discussing. I wonder if she'll try and use that to push the government proposals on immigration. Angela Rayner's been warning the government's ideas will make it harder for migrants already in the UK to settle. She says those are un-British and a breach of trust. And as you sort of alluded to earlier today, what is she up to? Why now at this intervention? Obviously, just as Keir Starmer, I think, has had a pretty good few weeks on Iran and sort of settling his leadership ambitions. Why come out with this sort of attack now? And I've just been speaking to MPs in Parliament who are eyebrows raised at why she is.
Would it have been scheduled, would it, for quite a long time or not?
I don't know. And to be honest, full disclosure, I didn't get the invite
good
to the mainstream party. I didn't get the invite to mainstream's Monday night drink, so I wasn't there. So I can't tell you whether it had been in the diary for a long time or not. But
she's a wily operator. She'd know exactly how this would be reported and how it would be picked up.
Of course she would. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the fact that she was speaking after Tony Vaughan, a very big critic on the government benches, of those immigration changes. But equally, it's not really been something that Angela Rayner has talked about too much before. So some of her critics are puzzling, sort of scratching their heads going, is this a political opportunity? Are you sniffing another government?
And she would be well aware that that would happen as well, whether it is an accurate assessment of events or not. I wonder, I mean, in my view, Keir Starmer has got Kemi Badenoch over a barrel for as long as this war goes on, because whatever she says, if she chooses to go back down that road, and listen, I wouldn't be 110% amazed if she didn't mention it at all, if she went full John Cleese.
Do you think we might be getting the sound effects
if Kemi Badenoch today did channel Basil Fawlty to such a degree that her contribution to PMQs essentially involved,
don't mention the war.
I was referring to the other sound effect.
What's the other one?
The ferret.
Yeah, we got the ferret?
Thank you
very much. What's that verb again?
Duking,
which is a word that Natasha Clark introduced us to last week. But listen, to be serious, she can't do anything now without him just pointing at her and laughing.
Yeah, it's going to be really hard for her to sort of turn this around on
from
around.
Full support to no support to insulting Donald Trump.
I don't think she would say full support of Donald Trump.
Well, of course she wouldn't, but she, I think she used those words.
I probably wouldn't
either. We should fully support our allies.
Did she say those words?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Maybe not.
I don't think fully supportive exactly Donald Trump words,
but well, maybe that was Nigel Farage, who's also, of course, undertaken a reverse vote, which is why he came first, not second last week, because his reverse vote was even
his,
more
his reverse vote was bigger than her.
Apparently, if you give him 76 quid, he'll record a cameo telling you that he thinks the war's a terrible idea.
I laughed so much at some of those outtakes.
How dare you? It's a very serious matter. He wants to be Prime Minister.
He does, and he's recording videos for... Actually, I think it's quite cheap, £75 a video for a personalised message.
We will cross live to the House of Commons as soon as Kemi Badenoch gets to her feet and asks her first question. Potholes? Could she go? I mean, I'm just thinking out loud. If she really did decide to go full Basil Fawlty,
doesn't
and not
feel like the week for potholes, does
no.
it? As much as people, I'm sure, across the UK.
So Angela Rayner,
our lovely drivers of
petrol.
LBC listeners, of course, care about
but
the state of roads.
Petrol,
but
even on petrol, he's going to say, "Hang on a minute,
well,
you were in favour of
week.
This war last week, and what effect do you think it's going to have on petrol prices if they start blowing up oil refineries in the Middle East?"
I think it's absolutely fair for her to raise fuel duty. I think the Prime Minister's got it right to not make a decision on fuel duty yet.
Yeah.
We do not know how long this war is going to last, and if oil prices come down again, he needs to reserve the right to take away that 5p cut, because it is very expensive.
Yes.
Despite the fact he's, of course, incredibly popular.
But you can't cast yourself as the great defender of drivers if you were also in favour of...
Exactly, a war that's blowing up
the fuel industry.
For sure.
He's got
a lot of ideas up his sleeve today. The other thing I wanted to mention, which may crop up as a joke... Zach Polanski's been giving a speech on the economy this morning, and Labour MPs more and more are now turning their attention to the Green Party in the wake of the Gordon and Denton by-election.
Oh, hang on, let's find out. More on that later.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister tried to avoid scrutiny on the Mandelson files by releasing the documents immediately after Prime Minister's questions last week. So let me ask him now. Did the Prime Minister... personally speak to Peter Mandelson about his relationship with the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein before appointing him as our ambassador to Washington?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, let me start where I must. This was my mistake in making the appointment, and I've apologised to the victims of Epstein. I do so again. The government is complying with the humble address in full, but we are also continuing to support the police in their investigation. The matter of process was looked at by the independent advisor on ministerial standards. It's clear the appointment process wasn't strong enough, and that's why I've already strengthened it. But it was my mistake, Mr. Speaker, and I've apologised for it. She should follow suit and apologise for her gross error of judgment in calling for the UK to join the war in Iran without thinking through the consequences.
Mr. Speaker, I know he doesn't want to talk about the documents he tried to bury last week. He's going to try and talk about anything else, but he's not going to get away with it. I asked him a question he did not answer. We know the Prime Minister was warned about the risk of appointing Peter Mandelson. This is not about the process. He knew that Mandelson stayed in Epstein's house after Epstein had been convicted for child prostitution. He knew that. So I will ask him again. Did he speak to Peter Mandelson about this before the appointment, yes or no?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I've already made clear that he was asked questions and gave untruthful replies. The government is complying with the humble address. The process has been set out. The independent advisor has looked at it. And he said, quote, the relevant process for a political appointee was followed. Now, obviously, this is a question of my judgment, but what about her judgment? She wanted to rush into a war with Iran without thinking it through. At the weekend, Mr. Speaker, three weeks in, she said, oh, there isn't a clear plan behind the US strikes in Iran. That's the question she should have asked at the start. The decision to commit the UK to a war is the biggest decision a Prime Minister can take, and she got it completely wrong.
I didn't hear an answer, Mr. Speaker, and he's right. It is about his judgment. He has repeatedly told us that Peter Mandelson lied to him, but he won't tell us if he actually picked up the phone and spoke to Mandelson before appointing him. This doesn't make any sense. The Prime Minister told us on the record, and I quote, I believed the lies he told me. If the Prime Minister didn't speak to him, how can he say he lied to him?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the process is clear. It's been looked at by the independent advisor. And she asked me about the process and judgment on appointments. She appointed the Shadow Justice Secretary. He said last night that Muslims praying in public, including the Mayor of London, practicing his faith, are not welcome. He described it as an act of domination, straight from the Islamist playbook. If we're in my team, it'd be gone. It's utterly appalling. She should denounce his comments and she should sack him.
He wants to talk about justice secretaries. His justice secretary is abolishing jury trials. Yeah. My shadow justice secretary is defending British values. I know who I would rather have sitting on the front bench next to me, and it's not him. But Mr. Speaker, this is important. He does want to talk about anything else except what I'm asking him. Three times I have asked him if the Prime Minister spoke to Peter Mandelson. Three times he has refused to answer. We can only assume he did not speak to Peter Mandelson. From the documents published, we know he left the questioning of Mandelson's relationship with a convicted paedophile to two of Mandelson's closest friends, one of whom was also friends with a convicted paedophile. Asking those questions should have been his job. Why did he fail to do his duty?
Mr. Speaker, so her position is that the Shadow Justice Secretary is defending British values when he says Muslims praying together in Trafalgar Square are not welcome. Mr. Speaker, even Tommy Robinson, I can hardly believe I'm saying this, has said today that if the Shadow Justice Secretary had made these hateful comments 2 years ago, the Conservative Party would have kicked him out. Now, Tommy Robinson isn't some sort of moral signpost. He was pointing out how much their party has changed. They're more inclined to his views, and he's right about that. The fact that he's sitting on her front bench shows she's too weak and has got absolutely no judgment.
The Prime Minister wants to talk about my leadership. I'm shocked because his former deputy has just fired the starting gun on the race to replace him. And I'll tell him one thing. She and I both agree that this weak man should be replaced by a strong woman. But I'm not finished, Mr. Speaker. I have too much to say to him. There is still a lot to ask about the Mandelson files. There's still a lot to ask. The Prime Minister knew that Mandelson had kept up a relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. The documents released also show he'd been warned about appointing Mandelson. He claims he was lied to. Mandelson had twice been fired for dishonesty. So why did the Prime Minister believe Peter Mandelson over the vetting documents?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, she asked about leadership. When I see religious events in Trafalgar Square, when I see Hindus celebrating Diwali, when I see Jews celebrating Hanukkah live, when I see Christians performing the Passion of Christ, or Muslims praying, that shows the great strength of our diverse city and country. I've never heard her party call out anything other than the Muslim events. It's only when Muslims are praying. The only conclusion is the Tory party has got a problem with Muslims.
Can I just say, people say, I am not responsible for the answers. I've just got to say that.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's a shame he's not responsible for the answers either. The Prime Minister wants us to believe that he is a serious leader, but he doesn't do the work. He outsources the decisions, and when things go wrong, he blames the vetting, he blames the Chief of Staff, he blames the Cabinet Secretary, he blames anyone but himself. This Prime Minister appointed Peter Mandelson, but didn't bother to ask the questions. If he cannot be straight with the House on something as simple as this, why should we believe a word he says about anything?
She talked about dozens of... 3 weeks ago, she said we should rush into war. She didn't do the work. She didn't think through the consequences. Committing our military to a war without thinking through the consequences is the gravest mistake a leader of the opposition can ever... And she comes back a week later and says, oops, I got that one wrong. She's utterly irrelevant and she's got no judgment. This is the leader of the opposition who said I should have empty chaired the most important NATO summit in years. He's the leader of the opposition who said Greenland is a second order issue. And this is the leader of the opposition who jumped into a war with Iran without stopping to think. On top of that this week, the failure to condemn and sack...
Order. And I will repeat again, I'm not responsible for the answers, but it's certainly not opposition questions.
Mr. Speaker, add to that the failure to condemn and sack the Shadow Justice Secretary for the poison and division that he spreads. It's turning out to be quite a month for the Leader of the Opposition, who claims she never makes any mistakes.
Mr. Speaker.
Claire Hannah.
We've seen this play out before, a US rush to military escalation with no plan for what comes next. We've seen schoolgirls bombed in Iran, whole families killed in Lebanon, chaos in a region already scarred by repression and genocide and economic shocks that hurt the most vulnerable at home. In Irish, there's a phrase, the Alter and Shane up we go, have we learned no lessons? People are asking exactly that. How many times do these horrors play out before the lessons are learned? The Prime Minister has said that the US will not be drawn into a wider war. Will he guarantee two things, that that position will hold in the face of mounting pressure from Trump and Netanyahu? And can he guarantee that this House would get a vote before the UK involves in any further conflict?
Prime Minister.
Unlike the Leader of the Opposition, my principles have been clear and unwavering. We will protect our people in the region. We will take action to defend ourselves and our allies, and we will not be drawn into the wider war. I want to see this war end as quickly as possible. Mr. Speaker, the longer it continues, the bigger the impact on the cost of living. And that's where we've intervened to support households with costs of heating oil. The best way forward is a negotiated settlement with Iran giving up any aspirations to develop a nuclear weapon.
Sir Ed David, Leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And can I join the Prime Minister in offering my condolences to the family and friends of the two young people who've been killed by the meningitis bug in Kent and all those affected by this horrifying outbreak. Mr. Speaker, Britain's independent nuclear deterrent is critical for the defence of our nation and for the whole of Europe. But the current Trident missiles will reach the end of their lives in the 2040s, so we have to make a choice now. Lease new missiles to the United States, accepting whatever terms the President gives us, or build our own here in the United Kingdom. And the Conservatives and Reform say we have to rely on President Trump and the United States because we couldn't possibly do it ourselves. Does the Prime Minister agree with them?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, our independent nuclear deterrent protects us every day, and we should never forget how important it is. And it is important that we renew it. We will do that in the best interests of Britain. I mean, he's openly advocating a plan which he doesn't know how much it would cost and how it would work. That isn't the way to deal with our independent nuclear deterrent.
Yeah. Sir Ed David.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm surprised at that response. The French can do it. Does the Prime Minister really think Britain can't? But moving on, Mr. Speaker, a new world investigation into GB News has found hundreds of shocking breaches of the rules of impartiality and accuracy. Yet Ofcom has repeatedly refused to take action. Andrew Neil says, just as Fox basically became the channel of Donald Trump, it is clear they have turned GB News into the Reform channel. Mr. Speaker, we cannot let GB News propaganda turn our great country into their version of Trump's America. Either the government rules aren't fit for purpose, or Ofcom isn't properly enforcing them. Prime Minister, which is it?
Prime Minister.
Well, he's right to raise an important question of free speech and our media. It is a matter for Ofcom, and it's important that we let them deal with it.
Uber Cumra.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Violence against women and girls is a global emergency.
And 60 minutes after 12 is the time. That reference there from Ed Davey to an investigation by the New World newspaper into GBBs and its extraordinary relationship with broadcasting regulations is going to be the subject of a conversation I'll be having with Alan Rusbridger, who has led that investigation. The former editor of The Guardian will be with us in the studio shortly after 12:30. And then shortly after 2:15, we'll be joined again by Guy Shrubsall, who you'll remember is the author of a bunch of books celebrating the British countryside, but also with a very political angle on the fact that it is the British countryside, i.e. it belongs to us, or should, or at least large parts of it that don't should. And he has got some very, very good news from the world of legislation, which might be one of the things that Keir Starmer could stick on his list of achievements. We'll find out more about that before 1 o'clock today. But after this break, it's picking over the bones of that mess.
This is LBC.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
At AJ Bell, we believe investing is for everyone. And when we say everyone, we mean your dad, Dan, Danielle, Dean, Dave, Dale, Dell's delivery driver Denise, Denise's dentist Dinesh, and Devon's strongest man, Donathan. Donathan? Donathan, that can't be right. Donathan? Well, whatever your name is, if you're a real person, investing is for you too. AJ Bell, feel good investing. The value of your investments can go up or down.
Go all Irish to France with great low prices. With Irish Ferries, you can for less. Irish Ferries, see travel differently. T's and C's apply.
If you were missold a home on a holiday park, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny.
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. They will affect how you manage your tenancies. Act now. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall. Energising a better Britain.
It is 19 minutes after 12 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I presume you've got the clip ready, Keith, because I think I deserve a lap of honour for pointing out that she had boxed herself into a position where, with regards to by far the single most important issue facing the world at the moment, Kemi Badenoch was compelled to channel Basil Fawlty.
Don't mention the war.
And she didn't.
She didn't.
She went for Mandelson, which neither of us really saw.
No, totally didn't see that coming.
In my case, you're more than welcome to scurry under this umbrella of defence, should you so desire, because Laurie Magnus has pronounced upon it, and then we wait for the police report into what Mandelson was up to. But the process was followed. That's what the independent advisor on ministerial ethics is for.
Yes, and Keir Starmer released these Mandelson files almost 2 weeks ago now. Sorry, no, was it last week after being
pronounced? Yeah, a week ago.
Sorry. So we haven't had an opportunity for Kevin Bacon.
How much you care.
Exactly. Sorry, it feels like months ago.
It does, it's
feels
true.
Like months
but
ago.
Because there's been a war, but of course, if you're the leader of the opposition, you can't mention that. That we haven't got this bit ready. Keith doing something else.
But yeah, it felt a little bit out of tune with exactly what we've been talking about on Iran, basically wall-to-wall coverage on Iran for the last sort of few weeks. It felt a little bit out of kilter. However, she did get completely annihilated over field duty last week. So I guess what was the point in having another go on it?
Yeah.
So it felt a bit of a nothing PMQs today. But interestingly, I thought the questions about the Prime Minister's judgment were interesting, and about Kemi Badenoch's judgment. They're both using that as a political argument to say, well, this guy makes errors in judgment here, and she's saying, and he's saying, well, you know, this woman makes political errors in judgment here. So I thought that was an interesting argument that they were both making.
Yeah, and well, I mean, one of them, of course, has referred that matter to the authorities, and one has refused, because Nick Timothy's comments are objectively disgusting. You know, I am a Catholic. I would have got my head chopped off in this country by the government a few hundred years ago for praying in public, and I thought we'd come far from them. But for Nick Timothy to attack people of a faith different from his for praying in public is absolutely disgusting. But if I were a neutral, a true neutral, like tuning in for the first time without really knowing anything about politics, I'd have been deeply unimpressed by both of them, because he didn't answer questions that many people listening would find perfectly plausible or easy to answer, albeit that it's all underpinned by the fact that she can't mention the war. He did at times seem to be channeling the two Ronnies, which you'll be too young to remember. They did a famous Mastermind sketch where Ronnie Barker was answering the previous question. I mean, it's a hilarious script, but it meant that he was answering the previous question, not the question that he'd actually been asked. And they were, like last week, we observed last week, it was as if they were both engaged in two completely different exercises.
That's totally agree with you there. Keir Starmer has, I think for the last year or so, I think there has been a growing pattern of him kind of trying to duck the questions and slightly avoid them. And for the second week in a row, you had Lindsay Hall, the Speaker, saying, this is not opposition questions. You're not meant to be asking questions of Kemi Badenoch. It's meant to be for you to answer.
It's a tactical decision, this.
I think so, yeah. And you know, instead he chose to turn the question of judgment around on her. And there are plenty of ways that he can do that, including the Nick Timothy tweet, including the comments that she's made on Iran. And I think Keir Starmer arguably has been having a good few weeks in this. He's really calmed his leadership speculation. And it did feel that these questions were slightly out of kilter. And it felt a bit of a rinse and repeat of last week, didn't it? Where they were just talking over each other, talking, having different conversations and not really engaging with each other, which is the point of Prime Minister's questions, is to show sort of your prowess with being able to engage and have that political argument. And it did feel like they were having two totally different conversations. And I do think it irritates people when Keir Starmer doesn't answer or at least address any of the issue questions. But equally, I think he has answered this one. He has answered the fact that on the Mandelson files, he feels that the due process was followed, but actually he feels like it wasn't strong enough and that he is going to be doing more to strengthen that process in the future. He wouldn't say if he personally spoke to Lord Mandelson, and that was something that Kemi Badenoch kept saying again and again and again. My question is, does it really matter?
I'm glad you said that, because if I said that, I'd be accused of having my scarf tied too tightly around my neck, whereas you managed to observe scrupulous impartiality. I don't think it does matter, really.
I suppose think it's strange that he didn't, because it's such a big
job. If he didn't, because he might have done. I mean, we don't know, is the point.
There has been some media reporting in the last few days, including, I think, the book out by Gabriel Pogrin and Patrick Maguire, which has an extract in it, which revealed last week that Keir Starmer did not talk to him
before
he appointed him.
So she knew the answer, and he wanted to get him to say it, and he has declined to say it, because then she could say, how could you appoint someone to be the ambassador without talking to them personally?
And that is a fair question, but it's probably not the most important question. I think the question of the Prime Minister's judgment is potentially a far bigger
one. Untouched by that, because you would simply point, so you think that he would, if he'd lied to all these other people, you think he wouldn't have lied to me?
I guess that's the point, but, you know, that's obviously not the case. You know, we know that Lord Mandelson...
It was Ronnie Corbett answering the questions and Ronnie Barker answering them, asking, I got that wrong as well, sorry.
Oh, it's good to clarify.
Having a great week. Just terrible.
Oh, sorry.
Don't mention the war.
Don't mention the war.
Don't mention Ronnie. And then Ed David. What, more on this? I mean, I share the general opinion. Well, some people have put it better than I've managed. Nigel says, very poor and not that one. Totally forgettable PMQs. And from both angles, Starmer ducking and weaving whilst landing a few blows, Badenoch swinging and missing repeatedly.
Yeah.
I'd probably be 52-48 on this.
Yeah, I don't think he was particularly good stump performance from her, but she wasn't totally awful either. But I didn't think Ed Davey was brilliant this week. Sorry, Lib Dems. I thought, you know, talking about nuclear in the sort of light of Donald Trump, and should we be diverging from America on that? And then a bit of an interesting question on GB News, which Keir Starmer completely refused to answer, saying that's important for free speech, but let's let Ofcom deal with it.
Well, that is what Ofcom's for, and Ofcom generally do a great job, and they can only, of course, respond to complaints. rights. They can only really launch investigations when people have complained. But we'll find out a lot more about this imminently, because Alan Rusbridger will be joining me shortly to talk us through this extraordinary investigation, which has prompted, as you heard, very strong criticism, even from the ridiculous but once esteemed and reputable figure of Andrew Neil. 26 minutes after 12 is the time. That's probably it. We kind of shows how rubbish it was this week. We're coming in 3 or 4 minutes early. Let's just randomly play the Don't Mention the War clip again, because it puts a smile on my face, Keith.
Don't mention the war.
Thank you.
The one thing that I think... What was that for?
He's gone rogue now.
He's just pressing buttons everywhere.
He's gone jazz.
The one thing that I think Kemi Badenoch did do well when she was talking about Angela Rayner, we both agree that he should be replaced by a strong woman. I think that was her only real saving grace of that PMQs. And actually, it was the one thing that we got right of predicting that Angela Rayner would come up at PMQs. I can't see that she's on the benches. I think it would have been a little bit embarrassing if she were on the back benches watching on that. But yes, it's a really interestingly timed intervention from Angela Rayner. And like I say, a lot of people scratching their heads wondering, why is she choosing this moment to intervene on the government's migration plans, and sort of what has she got planning potentially for after those May elections, when we know Keir Starmer is going to be facing a really rough ride.
Indeed he is. I had a thought, which is always dangerous, about, and I hope I haven't misremembered, when Boris Johnson, probably the thing he got most right, arguably the only thing he got right during his premiership, was the response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And Starmer was four square behind him, I think.
On
the Ukraine question.
I believe so.
So for a leader of the opposition at a time of international war to fully support the Prime Minister's position...
It's not completely unheard of.
Well,
sure.
I think it's almost normal. I'm pretty sure it happened during Iraq as well, for good or for ill, of course, because most people have retrospectively changed their mind over Iraq. But it is one of those moments when you expect the House of Commons to come together. And the absurdity of the position that she now finds herself in other words, being unable to mention the biggest story in the world because she's made such a mess of her initial response to it. This could have been an opportunity for her to push Farage further into the margins as well by actually sounding as if they were prioritizing the national interest over sycophancy to Trump, but she's completely blown that now. There's no way back, really, is there, on this? Because any time it appears, he just points out the ferrets.
Yeah, it's interesting because she's had this her entire sort of career as leader of the opposition. She's been very aligned with Donald Trump's America. I don't think she's maybe potentially realised that a lot of the country are not with Donald Trump anymore, and a lot of the country realised that the American relationship is, people, you know, agree with the stance mostly, I think, that Keir Starmer is generally, or has been taken at least the last year, trying to be on his good side, but equally when there are issues of difference. But she has always wanted to cozy up to America under Donald Trump, and I think it would be silly for her to go, actually, you know what, no, I support the Prime Minister on this. I can't remember an occasion, can you, James, when Kemi Badenoch has ever gone to the dispatch box and said, I agree with the Prime Minister's position on this, I'm fully supportive of him on this. And I think, actually, it really does show the depth of a politician when they're able to do that. You can agree. It's what politics is good to show that happens, isn't it?
It's actually why I invented the word footballification, for precisely that reason, long before I even knew Kemi Badenoch existed. It was a way of describing how dangerous for everybody, how dangerous for democracy is, if you base your opinion on any political moment on the colour of the scarf that you've got tied around your neck, rather than on the events unfolding on the pitch in front of you. And you can be the biggest Kidderminster Harriers fan on the planet, but if Chester score a glorious goal, you've got to give them the credit for scoring a glorious goal on occasion. But of course, some football fans are categorically incapable of ever seeing any wrongness on their own side or any goodness on the other.
And that's the case with MPs of all parties and all political colours. There are some MPs on the outskirts of every political party who just refuse to talk to people on the other end of the spectrum.
I think that's terrible.
Do you think
it's terrible as well. Don't get me wrong. That's one of the reasons why I'm not a politician. But I've met not all of them, because of course there'd be some that you could break bread with.
I think it's a good look.
Have common ground with, and I used to be able to list them off the top of my head, but of course none of them are in Parliament anymore because Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings chucked them all out.
Yeah.
Thank you, Natasha. No lapse of honour for us. I get one for the Don't Mention the War.
Well, yeah, that was obvious, though, wasn't it?
Was it?
Yeah.
You didn't say it.
Well, she was going to talk about, not going to talk about Iran.
I thought she might mention it. I didn't think she would have the front not to, actually. which is why I said there is a slim possibility that she won't mention at all the single most important question that the government is currently facing.
Do you think she will next week? Is it too early to say?
No, I don't think she can, actually, now. Well, but we've got that now, that proof that she's frightened of bringing the subject up at all. But then, of course, we're talking about the Queen of Reverse Ferrets.
Yeah.
Which was the name of my first band. Here's Tim Humphrey with your headlines.
GPs are being told to prescribe antibiotics to anyone who visited a Kent nightclub earlier this month after its links to a meningitis outbreak. 20 cases are being investigated with vaccines offered to university students in Canterbury. Prime Minister Keir Starmer says his thoughts are with those affected by the outbreak. And Keir has told MPs he wants the conflict in Iran to end as soon as possible, but he says he still prefers a negotiated settlement. A funeral is being held in Iran for a senior official killed in an Israeli airstrike. Security Chief Ali Larijani was a key advisor to the country's regime. LBC weather, sunshine for most, the odd shower for northwestern areas of Scotland, and a very mild day for some, with a high of 20 degrees.
LBC.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades, and why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing, you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no, just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
This Easter, switch your phone from home mode to unlimited data in Tokyo mode, so you can find mind-blowing ramen and not something that tastes like you just ate it at your desk.
Ooh.
Get all the data you need abroad with no dodgy Wi-Fi, no roaming charges, and no nasty bills with an unlimited eSIM from Aerolo. Visit aerolo.com to switch on holiday mode next time you travel. Check your device compatibility.
This is the 810 to Birmingham New Street. Calling at Organise To-Do List. Call your PA. Shoot off a few emails. Close laptop. Head to the shop. Man behind the counter seems like a good egg. Thinking of eggs, one breakfast butty, please.
Business travel by train is time well spent with Avanti West Coast.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
It is 12:33. It was rather felicitous is a good word, isn't it, of Ed Davey to mention the New World newspaper's investigation into GB News, or GBB to its friends, that has been published today, because the author of that investigation, Alan Rusbridger, former editor, of course, of The Guardian and Prospect magazine, it was scheduled to join me in the studio anyway. But I guess that makes the leader of the Liberal Democrats your warm-up man today.
I couldn't ask for more.
You couldn't ask for more. And I was, you know, funnily enough, I was thinking about the New World anyway because of the report that your political editor, James Ball, did on the fact that the Panorama broadcast, which contained the misleading Donald Trump quotes, he was the only journalist who noticed that the bloke responsible for that report, Michael Prescott, had himself doctored the Trump quotes in the anti-BBC report that he put together for...
That was a very good spot.
It was, and yeah. It still hasn't really been properly examined. And we've just pointed out on the radio that the Daily Telegraph today has managed to report on Donald Trump's comments yesterday without mentioning his claim that the BBC thing was generated by AI, which seemed like an extraordinary lie to share in the Oval Office. But that's not why you're here. You're here because... The front page story today in the New World is how GB News became Reform TV, and your words, they're definitely not mine, because I too am regulated by Ofcom, how our useless state regulator lets them get away with it. Why did you undertake this investigation?
Because it's fascinated me how, I mean, it's Andrew Neil is in this piece who says essentially what's happened is that GB News has become Reform TV. And on the face of it, that's quite a statement that a political party has got its own broadcasting channel. That sort of thing happens in Turkey or other countries we can think of, not supposed to happen here. And I think the problem is that the people who really love GB News watch it. They never complain about it, because why would they? Because they really like it. And people who might complain it don't watch it. So I had the idea of getting 20 journalists from a variety of publications just to sit down and watch it. And I gave them a form and said, can you mark it for accuracy, impartiality, range of views, challenge, context, all the things that the law says are supposed to happen. And I asked them at the end to score it 0 to 5. 5, completely compliant with Ofcom. 0, not at all. And the overall score was 1.5. And there are numerous, numerous glaring instances of this TV station driving a coach and horses through the rules that Ofcom is supposed to enforce.
We'll look at the example shortly, but just for clarity, I presume that all 20 were not culled from your contacts book when you were editor of The Guardian.
They've asked to remain nameless because some of them are still working for other publications. But, you know, there's The Spectator, Sunday Telegraph, Times, Guardian, a range of outlets, BBC, ITV.
Daily Mail.
Daily Mail, yeah. And they weren't marking it for the views.
Exactly
They were marking it for simply for compliance with what Ofcom is supposed to regulate.
Of course, if Boris Johnson had had his way, Paul Dacre would now be in charge of Ofcom.
There was a 2-year period where there was shenanigans, where Johnson was trying repeatedly to get Dacre in, and they ended up with Michael Grade, but not without shenanigans about trying to get a Tory peer in.
So what sort of things did your panel discover?
Well, the format for the programmes, we looked at the evening programmes, is you have a highly opinionated presenter, often people who are reform candidates, reform politicians, or Brexit MPs, former Brexit MPs, who come on and do a rant at the top of the programme.
God damn, with that sort of
thing. That's terrible. And they will then have 4 or 5 guests who agree with them, and maybe one who doesn't. And equally wrong, I think, there's one program by Matt Goodwin that we, the guy who stood as a candidate in Gorton and Denton.
How did he get on, Alan?
He had a program where he obviously chose all 4 subjects.
Right.
And they were all to do with immigration. So, you know, you've got the entire day's news, and he was obsessed with boat people, immigration, refugee camps, etc., etc. So by the choice of the presenter, by the choice of the guest, by the choice of the subjects, this is just nothing like the what Ofcom demands, which is due impartiality.
And, I mean, anybody wondering what the difference is between GBBs and LBC, the difference is our presenting roster, because if we were all singing from the same hymn sheet as presenters...
That would be as bad.
I hope this doesn't come as a major shock to anybody, but people like, for example, Nick Ferrari and I disagree on many, many issues. Ditto Ian Dale and others. So that is the crucial point here, is that if we were all as presenters, both controlling the programme and presenting it from a very particular political position, even with the occasional token voice of dissent on a panel, for example, then we would be falling foul of the regulations that we understand Ofcom is designed to endorse. One question that intrigues me is whether or not, because you're very specific that it's become Reform TV, if I was watching this as a conservative, well, 2 types of conservative, either as a sort of Dominic Grieve school of conservatism, as in relatively sane, or as a sort of Kemi Badenoch school of conservatism, as in essentially trying to eat Reform's lunch, would I be troubled by this? Would I care about this? Does it?
I think you would. I mean, the 4 Tories they've had presenting, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Miriam Cates, Philip Davis, and Esther McVeigh, are all from the right of the Conservative Party.
Yes.
They've had Nigel Farage, Lee Anderson, Darren Grimes, Richard Tice, Matt Goodwin, all Reform politicians. They've even got people, there's a guy called Martin Daubney, who was a Brexit MEP before becoming deputy leader of Lawrence Fox's Reclaim Party, which is to the right of the Reform Party. So they look as though they've been hand-picked for their views. And unlike the BBC, where you're supposed to leave your political views at the door, when you walk through, they are positively encouraged to vent their views.
You mentioned Miriam Cates. Has she? I think I just saw this morning that she's been interviewing Viktor Orban in the
It wouldn't surprise me.
Which brings us to an interview conducted with Donald Trump in November of 2025, which one of your panel picked up on as being a heinous example of. I think the only word we could use really is sycophancy, isn't it? Because Ofcom is pretty clear on false or contentious factual statements being challenged or corrected, and they were.
This was like a fangirl interview. Mm. So Donald Trump said things like climate change is a hoax. He said the Chinese build all these wind farms, but they don't have any wind farms. I mean, just things that are completely untrue. And she gushed at the end of that segment. She said, oh, how wonderful that you go around dropping these truth bombs. And she didn't challenge him on anything. Now, Ofcom, they had 32 complaints. It was actually a 38 degrees petition, which had something like 60,000 complaints. Mm. And Ofcom said, oh, that's all right, because later in the same program, in the middle of the night, UK time, there were one or two guests who did challenge some of this. I mean, I couldn't help contrast it with an Ofcom judgment of 2017, a 12-page judgment when they looked at the BBC and picked them up on the Today programme for having Nigel Lawson talking about how climate change was a hoax and not picking him up on it.
Mm.
So something since 2017, something radical has happened inside Ofcom where they just waved this stuff through.
Do we get any insights into what that might have been? I know that Chris Banatvila, who was Ofcom's founding director of standards, referred to the interview you've just described as the most nakedly partial interview I think I've ever seen. But do you make any progress into the question of what might explain that measurable shift in policy that you've just referred to?
That is the great mystery. I mean, you could see what Johnson was trying to do by putting Paul Dacre in there. The regulator.
And Charles Moore, of course, would have been in charge at the BBC at the same time, which is Viktor Orban levels of state media control.
That's the dream ticket. I put all this stuff to to Ofcom, and they had promised me an interview, and then they came back and said, I'm afraid we can't make this work. So I didn't have the chance to ask Ofcom.
If they were making money, there would be at least a commercial defence of this. Are they making money?
There are two main backers. One is Sir Paul Marshall, who's behind Unheard, a big Brexit backer, now owner of The Spectator, wanted to own The Telegraph.
Found and the other posted is, some pretty hideous or liked some pretty hideous tweets.
He did, and there's a remarkable, actually, overlap between those tweets and the views of GB News. So he says
a lot
those
of anti-Islamic,
absolutely.
Anti-immigrant,
he says those
anti-refugee.
Tweets don't represent his views.
Okay, what an extraordinary coincidence.
And the other is a outfit called the Legatum Group, which is based in Dubai. And between them, they've lost well over £100 million on GB News so far.
So, in your view, what are they getting in return?
Well, they think, and Marshall has said this, that by the next election, Ofcom will be up there with the BBC. They will be the two main broadcasters in the country, and they have strong views, and they want those views out there.
Unchallenged.
Unchallenged, yeah. And I spoke to Andrew Neil, who was the founder of GB News, and asked him, you know, what went wrong. And he said, well, he was explicit. He didn't want Britain to have a Fox News-style operation. And he said it became apparent that these people who were obsessively pro-Brexit, they did want a Fox News channel. It was his words. He said, this has become Reform TV. And as you know, Andrew Neil is no shrinking liberal.
Mm. Now, if only someone had pointed out to him what he was likely to be presiding over at the time. The numbers are relatively small, aren't they, in terms of viewers?
What they do is to chunk everything down. Their figures say that they had 2.5 billion streams on social media last year, 2.5 billion. So they are reaching a very, very big audience. But it's quite clever the way they take little chunks of these programs and put them out on social media, on YouTube. So they're reaching a very, very big audience, even if the sort of hour-by-hour figures aren't startling.
And it is essentially the propaganda arm of Nigel Farage's political party.
Several people have said that.
Alan Rusbridge, thank you. I mean, it's an incredibly exhaustive investigation, isn't it?
Well, all credit to the New World who've given it. I think it's 12 pages, it's all on the website.
Which dropped through my letterbox this morning. Yeah. And you can find it on the New World website as well. I should share what Ofcom have said this morning to us, that our broadcasting rules strike a careful balance between protecting viewers from harm and preserving broadcasters' and audiences' rights to freedom of expression. We apply these standards fairly and equally to all Ofcom licensees. When they fall short, we take action, as we have with GB News in recent years. Our rules around due impartiality and accuracy in news ensure that audiences are not misled and are offered a range of alternative views and perspectives. Importantly, due impartiality does not mean strictly impartial or neutral, nor is it a mathematical construct where equal airtime must be given to each opposing view. How broadcasters achieve due impartiality is not dictated by the regulator. It is an editorial decision for them, and Ofcom does not impose a single approach.
Well done, you did that with a straight face.
I absolutely did it with a straight face. One thing you can always do in these circumstances is open the phone lines and allow ordinary people to take on a presenter and explain why.
There's a thought.
Would never catch on.
Yeah, okay.
Alan Rusbridge, thank you very much.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Joe Kent says Benjamin Netanyahu forced the US president's hand. Should King Charles go to the United States? And is public prayer an act of domination?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
A Thameslink train is a place where you can just switch off. Where you have the chance to scroll your feeds as you roll past fields. Or simply relax with a podcast, playlist or power nap. Go with your flow and save with advanced tickets at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
A spectacle far beyond your imagination. Be amazed. Be moved. Be there. For an experience that will stay with you forever. Disney's The Lion King at London's Lyceum Theatre. Book now at thelionking.co.uk.
Tesco Insurance are driving down the cost of motoring with 10% off car insurance. Take out a car insurance policy before the 15th of May 2026 and you'll get 10% off with club card prices. We offer a range of cover options so you can choose the one that's right for you. Save 10% when you buy or renew a car policy with Tesco Insurance. Search Tesco Car Insurance and get a quote direct today. Club card required. Excludes add-ons. T's and C's apply.
At AJ Bell, we believe investing is for everyone. And when we say everyone, we mean your dad, Dan, Danielle, Dean, Dave, Dale, Dell's delivery driver Denise, Denise's dentist Dinesh, and Devon's strongest man, Donathan. Donathan? Donathan, that can't be right. Donathan? Well, whatever your name is. If you're a real person, investing is for you too. AJ Bell, feel good investing. The value of your investments can go up or down.
A message from TfL.
I saw Alicia's photo in my newsfeed. All I can think of is her family. How they're getting on. If they're getting on. I didn't look when I pulled out, and she never made it home. Sounds crazy, but it felt like her motorbike came out of nowhere. But I know the truth. I didn't look again.
Drivers, take another look, not a life. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, energising a better Britain.
It's 12:49. This is a nice comment from a journalist called Nicola Chester, who is one of the finest sort of rural affairs nature writers out there. She's written this morning, "This is a game-changing, hugely important piece of work that history will remember. Hard work, diligence, resilience and tenacity paying off for the greater good. Guy Shrubsole is a folk hero for our times, an ambitious step towards making England a greener, fairer and more pleasant land." The last bit, I think, a quote from you. Guy Shrubsole. A folk. Did you know you were a folk hero for our time? Do you have a ukulele?
I don't. I do know some people who do, and they all talk about land rights a lot as well.
Yes. what's happened? What is Nicola and you and many others so excited about today?
Well, I'm very elated because this morning the government have announced that they are going to be opening up the land registry. And that means that we may finally discover who actually owns England. This is something that I've been campaigning for 10 years now. And, you know, land ownership in England is one of our oldest and darkest secrets. It goes all the way back to the Norman Conquest, to William the Conqueror, to Doomsday Book. And it's who owns land has always been bound up with wealth and power in this country. So you can imagine my delight to see that something that I've been talking about for 10 years and that many people have been pushing for and working on has now finally become government policy.
So there's the most obviously the environmental impacts, but this is political as well. I mean, this is about how a society operates.
Absolutely. I think there's huge benefits to opening up the data that has been locked behind the closed walls of the land registry, the government's official body for registering who owns land in England and Wales, it has to be said as well. And, you know, there's huge benefits, I think, of greater transparency for landowners and farmers themselves, because actually it should become easier for farmers and landowners to look up and find who owns land in their catchment, to collaborate with them, to apply for government funding for nature restoration projects. But I also think this is about greater public scrutiny of who owns land. It's about campaign groups, citizens, civil society being able to say to the largest landowners, who really ought to be bearing the greatest responsibility for things like restoring nature, for making us more resilient to climate change impacts, to reduce flood risk by changing the way they manage their land, they should be held more to account. And I think that's what this will help to do.
And I think you've just answered the question I was about to ask you, which was why has there been so much secrecy? Why, if I owned huge swathes of England, would I be so keen to keep it on the quiet?
Well, I think it all comes back to power, doesn't it? It's, you know, we know that England is owned, half of England is owned by less than 1% of the population. This is something that has been a level of inequality for 1,000 years.
I'm thinking of people who don't realise that, half of England.
But, you know, this is so what's happened today, and the government are bringing out later today their land use framework. This is the first time there's been a land use framework for England. In my view, it's one of the most far-sighted documents for, you know, how we use and manage land since the Second World War. I think it points the way to a greener, fairer and more pleasant land in England. Hmm. And although it's coming out later today, I have been passed a copy of it by a journalist earlier today. You know, perhaps read out one or two of the things that it says just to kind of be really clear about what this is going to involve. And on the land registry, they talk in there about they say they will to improve transparency and accuracy of land ownership data. We will work with HM Land Registry this year to provide access to free spatial land ownership data for larger properties covering the vast majority of England and Wales, excluding homeowners. So just to pick that apart a bit, it's really good they're talking about doing that this year. It means it has to happen very soon. They're talking about access to free data. They're talking about access to spatial data. That means maps of who owns what where. And they're talking about opening up information on larger properties covering the vast majority of England now and excluding homeowners. I think that's good.
Yes.
Because it's putting in safeguards around privacy.
Yes.
Obviously completely reasonable and understandable, but it's also putting much more information out there about who owns the vast majority of our countryside and our landscapes.
We've got a few minutes, so I'll indulge myself a little bit, or at least indulge my curiosity. When did your passion for this topic begin? What prompted this fascination and enthusiasm?
I think there are two things, really. I'm an environmental campaigner, first and foremost. I'm fascinated by how we use and misuse land. And in looking into that more than 10 years ago, I started to kind of realise that actually who owns land obviously has a huge influence on how land is used.
Because if you don't know who owns it, you can't agitate for things to be done with it.
Exactly. And private property rights obviously have huge powers associated with them. You know, if you own a grouse moor in the northern peat bogs of England, you have a huge influence over how that land is used and whether it is emitting carbon or storing carbon. But there was another reason as well, because it's actually not a coincidence that I started investigating this 10 years ago, just shortly after Brexit happened. we were being told all the time by the people in the Brexit campaign that this was about taking back control. Well, I decided that I wanted to look into who actually controls the most fundamental thing in this country, which is who owns our land.
Yes.
So I think maybe we might be finally on the verge of really taking back control.
This is spooky, because I wasn't going to mention this because I thought I'd sound a bit daft, but I was thinking when I was reading your celebrations this morning and preparing to talk to you, I was thinking that if I was the kind of person who thought that I would articulate my patriotism by climbing up a lamppost in Bromsgrove and sticking a polyester union flag to the top of it, and let's presume for the sake of argument that I'm just a little bit misguided as opposed to anything uglier than that, this is what I should really care about. If I really care about the country and the people, the population, the English population, the population of England, then living in a place where huge tracts of land are anonymously owned and controlled should be a huge affront to my patriotic heart.
Absolutely. I've always seen trying to investigate who owns England as a patriotic project.
Yes.
It's about reclaiming a sense of what England is, who controls this, who holds...
But your book, Who Owns England, is what actually turned me onto this entire subject in the first place, of course.
Yeah, so, you know, people like Nigel Farage, if he wants to oppose this as he strides around the country...
Dressed like a comedy farmer in
his barber jacket, yes, and mustard coloured trousers, saying we need to bring back fox hunting.
Yes,
he's welcome to join the ranks of the landed aristocracy in opposing this. But I know that the vast majority of people in this country want to understand who owns the countryside, and that reclaiming it for everybody, so that this is an England where everybody feels welcome and can belong and can roam in the countryside as well.
That's another part of it as well, really important. It's simple access, which is probably the easiest thing for people to understand. What about some of the things that are a bit less easy, Guy, finally? What would you be looking to next as evidence of how effective and important this legislation has been?
Well, I'd like to see, I'd like to see the largest landowners held to account for what they're doing with their land. And I do think there will be things in the land use framework that will help to do that. I think there should be mandatory reporting by some of the largest landowners on what they're doing to restore nature, to lock up carbon in soils.
That's peat.
Peat bogs, yeah. To plant more trees, to restore temperate rainforests. I think that ultimately this country belongs to everybody. And this is about creating a greater sense of belonging in England. That's what true patriotism and a true sense of nationhood should be about.
And that's my kind of politics. I recommend Who Owns England by Guy Shrubsole as an introduction to this, but I suppose in many ways the framework to be unveiled by the Environment Secretary Emma Reynolds later today in the House of Commons. Are you allowing yourself a lap of honour, Guy?
I might allow myself a small one.
A small lap of honour. What are you working on next?
I'm actually writing a new book called The Ghosts of Chalk Country.
Oh, lovely.
Which will be about wildflowers, it will be about fertility, it will be about freedom, and it will be about fascism. And that question of what is England and what is Englishness.
Look forward to it. All the Fs. Guy Shrubsole, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I mean, also, wonderful to talk about something that's happening in politics that is literally for the greater good, in the purest sense of the phrase. We're almost done, which means I'm about to hand over to Sheila. But before I do that, can we just clear something up? Because not only are there rumours afoot that I am loggerheads with Henry Reilly. With Henry Reilly over the fact that he is trying to eat my lunch whenever he comes into the studio to perform Reilly's Reform Roundup. But yesterday, as I prepared to hand over to you, I ended with a very cheery Happy St. Patrick's Day message. And you came on the radio and you completely failed to acknowledge me. You didn't wish me a St. Patrick's Day.
It was the massive gap that made
and
it even
And there was
more
also a long pause, yeah, as if I'd done something to offend you. Can we just clear this up, please?
Yes, we can.
Thank you.
I would never do that to you. Live.
No.
Not live. No, what had happened is we had some essential drilling maintenance work going on outside the studio, yeah, so I had to pre-record my thanks, James.
I see.
So we were trying to fake it till we made it, and we blew it.
And I blew it by going too personal.
You went too friendly, yeah.
Story of my
and
life.
And don't do that again, James.
Story of my life.
But I love him dearly, really. Honest. Honest.
But Henry Reilly and I do actually hate each other. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player Player app or the LBC app, where you can also stay up to date with all the latest news, videos and opinion. Podcast galore, including James O'Brien Daily, the best bits from my LBC show. And full disclosure, is it Billy Idol? Is it still Billy Idol? It's a brilliant interview, that. And well, my bits aren't great, but his are. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick. But now, oh, it's great to see you, she. It's Sheila Fogarty.
Thanks, James. Thank you, James. Always a joy. Now, is public prayer an act of domination? I want to talk about that at 3. Some MPs seem to think so at 2. Should King Charles go to America? President Trump seemed to confirm the King's US state visit yesterday, didn't he? By saying that he was looking forward to hosting him very shortly. The palace has yet to announce details of the visit, so let's talk about that at 2. But I'm going to start with the war in Iran. So much still to talk about. Why did President Trump go to war with Iran when he did? And how he did. Joe Kent, the man who's resigned, says Benjamin Netanyahu forced the US president's hand. Whose war is this? Is it Donald Trump's? Is it Benjamin Netanyahu's?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, virtual queuing systems have been set up for meningitis vaccinations after 20 cases were confirmed in Canterbury. Two people have died since the outbreak was first reported on Saturday. The jabs are being offered to students who are being advised to watch out for symptoms. Our South East of England correspondent Emma Corr is in Canterbury.
Here on the University of Kent campus, the vaccine programme will be rolled out to 5,000 students living in halls. The concern is, though, that many students may have already left campus and headed home for the Easter break early. Some students queuing for antibiotics here earlier, telling me they're taking all the precautions they can.
The funeral has been held for an Iranian security chief killed in an Israeli airstrike. Ali Larijani was one of Iran's most powerful figures. Meanwhile, Keir Starmer has told the Commons the UK will not be drawn into the wider war in Iran. He told MPs he would continue to protect British people and interests in the region, but would not go further with military action.
I want to see this war end as quickly as possible. Mr. Speaker, the longer it continues, the bigger the impact on the cost of living. And that's where we've intervened to support households with costs of heating oil. The best way forward is a negotiated settlement with Iran giving up any aspirations to develop a nuclear weapon.
Green Party leader Zach Polanski has called for the UK to replace its failing budget rules with fiscal referees. In his first major speech on the economy, he said the fiscal framework is overly sensitive to market movements, which generates policy uncertainty. He also called for a wealth tax. Former MP Crispin Blunt has been charged with drugs offences, including possession of Class A and Class B substances. The CPS said it follows police visiting his home in Hawley in Surrey in October 2023 in relation to a separate matter. Senegal are to appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport after being stripped of the Africa Cup of Nations trophy. Opponents Morocco have been announced as the new champions 2 months after they lost the final. Senegal were punished for walking off the pitch when a penalty was awarded against them late on. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 43 points at 10,447. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.16. LBC weather, sunshine for most, the odd shower in northwestern areas of Scotland, a very mild day for some, and a high of 20 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Tim Humphrey.
Sorry to interrupt your day, but I've just been diagnosed with dementia, and I'm going to need your help. I'll need help when I can no longer button a shirt or recognise my own family. My daughter will need help too. I worry this could ruin her life. And we will all need help to find a cure to end the devastation of dementia. I can't do this alone.
It will take a society to beat dementia. Alzheimer's Society.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. I want to know what you think about this claim by Joe Kent, who's resigned, the counterterrorism expert that resigned from the Trump administration. He seems to be saying that the real special relationship, because we talk about it all the time, don't we, the special relationship between the US and the UK. He seems to be suggesting that the real one, doesn't use the language, but the real special relationship is between Trump and Netanyahu. And I wonder whether Joe Kent's resignation is the start of the Trump, if not the whole administration, then certainly the Republican Party, the MAGA movement, turning against Donald Trump in a much more active way. I can't help thinking back to the days after October the 7th, when Joe Biden, then president, went to stand literally shoulder to shoulder with Benjamin Netanyahu and expressed the horror of what had happened on October the 7th, quite rightly, but also issued a gentle but very clear warning to Israel, to Benjamin Netanyahu, not to make the mistakes that America had made after 9/11. And we know that the relationship between Biden and Netanyahu was nothing like the relationship, much warmer, closer relationship that we see between Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. Donald Trump was asked yesterday about Joe Kent's resignation in the Oval Office as he met the Irish Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, on St. Patrick's Day.
Well, I read his statement. I always thought he was a nice guy, but I always thought he was weak on security, very weak on security. I didn't know him well, but I thought he seemed like a pretty nice guy. But when I read his statement, I realized that it's a good thing that he's out, because he said that Iran was not a threat. Iran was a threat. Every country realized what a threat Iran was. The question is whether or not they wanted to do something about it. And many people, many of the greatest military scholars, are saying for years that president should have taken out Iran because they wanted a nuclear weapon.
Well, yesterday on Tonight with Andrew Marr here on LBC, Ambassador John Bolton, the former US National Security Advisor in the first Trump administration and former ambassador to the United Nations, was asked about Joe Kent's resignation.
I don't think myself Iran posed an imminent threat. I don't think we have to wait for an imminent threat. He was one of the isolationists in a very senior position in the administration. So I'm glad he's resigned. Maybe his boss, Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, will resign next. That would be another good thing. And I just note, in a rare moment of agreement, Donald Trump has called Kent's resignation a good thing. So that there must be something to it.
Is there a wider split going on in the MAGA movement or on the right of American politics between, as it were, the traditional Republican worldview and the isolationists?
Yeah, I think the split is pretty clear. I believe the isolationist wing in the Republican Party is actually quite small. But it is a part of the larger Trump base that has been that way for many, many years. I mean, within the administration, J.D. Vance, the vice president, is the leading isolationist.
Yes.
He really can't resign. But I think it's possible that some others will break away. And this is a problem Trump will have. There's no doubt. Unique among Republicans who normally didn't attract isolationists like this to begin with.
Well, I'm joined by Mark Polymeropoulos, a highly decorated former CIA operations officer who specialised in counterterrorism, the Middle East and South Asia. Mark, great to have you on the show again. Why don't we start with the relationship that you have observed between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, hot on the heels of Biden and Obama's presidencies. How would you describe it, characterise it?
So I think, well, first of all, it's great to be back with you. I love coming on the show to do kind of these deep dives. I mean, you know, the relationship between Donald Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu, we'll call him Bibi, you know, is obviously very close, but it's not as ironclad sometimes as people think. And, you know, clearly it's better than it was with former President Joe Biden. Biden was able to push back on Bibi. Same thing.